I'm Fiona Hill, the Director of the Centre for the US and Europe, and I want to welcome all of you here today on this very steamy July afternoon. Very impressed by how many people have turned out, either you're escaping the steam by coming in for the air conditioning or you're here for the coffees and cookie. But I suspect that you're actually here because Ukraine is very much in the news. And we're really privileged and honoured today to proceed with this workshop on where is Ukraine going and how the West should respond, because we have really an excellent group of participants, not just some familiar faces from here in Washington, D.C., for those of you who are regulars on the think tank conference circuit, but also because we have some special guests from Ukraine itself, which really bucks the usual trend of D.C. when we spend a lot of time talking about countries and places and issues without the actual participation of many of the people who things directly concern. So for this first panel in our workshop, we're going to focus on the domestic situation within Ukraine. And we're going to actually begin with some short comments from our assembled panelists. You have all of the information and the biographies of our participants. And we're especially delighted that we've got from the presidential administration of Ukraine, Yevgen Burkhat, who's here on my right-hand side. Many of you actually might recognize Yevgen because he's not a stranger to Washington, D.C., and has been here in the past in other capacities. So he has the unique advantage of the inside-outside perspective on both Ukraine and on Washington. We're going to follow Yevgen with, on my left, Nadia Duke, who I know many people in the audience know very well. Nadia also has strong roots in Ukraine, and it's just a coincidence that Nadia and I also seem to have British accents. That's not a coincidence. That's not really the case at all. But Nadia is one of those unusual people who has lived in many places simultaneously and has all kinds of different perspectives, but obviously has a deep affiliation with Ukraine, as well as working here for the National Endowment for Democracy. Nadia's left, we had Adrian Kantinsky, who many of you may remember from his work many years ago with Freedom House, but is now a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council and doing a lot of other interesting things. And also Adrian has a long and deep interest in Ukraine and first-hand experience. And then we have Sam Charup from the Center for American Progress, who we're going to ask to give a more of a Western DC perspective on where the debate is about Ukraine's domestic development. We'll break at 3 o'clock and then move seamlessly after a 15-minute break into the second panel, which will really look at the Western perspective. And my colleague Steve Pfeiffer, foreign ambassador to Ukraine, will be joined by other colleagues who will talk about that, as well as Andrew Fialko, who is one of the senior advisors to President Yanukovych, who is sitting here in the front of the audience and who will be seeing more of on the second panel. So without any further ado, I will turn to Yevgen to ask him to give the perspective from Kiev, and then we'll just move along to the panel, and then we'll open it up to the floor for questions and discussion. Thank you again, Yevgen, for joining us.
Thank you, Fiona. Do you hear me all right?
I think we might need to...
Is it better?
Let's try to move this up a little bit. There we go. Let's try that.
Now it's better. All right, I will try to outline shortly the political situation and reforms in Ukraine as it's seen in the presidential administration. So this year, presidential election in Ukraine has augmented the end of permanent political crisis and constant infighting between different branches of power. At last, Ukrainian government has become a team of professionals united by one goal. The president, the parliamentary coalition, and the cabinet of ministers can finally focus on critically needed comprehensive reforms that can change life of Ukrainians for the better. Constitutional, judicial, and election system reforms are long past due, and only a professional team of experts reinforced with the political will of the president has the capacity to bring them through. Ukraine's democratic development, strengthening of civil society and the rule of law are among the top priorities for the president. Support and promotion of freedom of speech and human rights protection is an integral part of and a key element of his political agenda. President's recent statement that freedom of speech is guaranteed by the Ukrainian constitution and that interference in the work of journalists is not acceptable and will be prosecuted once again reconfirms the importance of this issue for the president and the society. On recent meeting of the President's Public Humanitarian Council, the President presented the concept of national public television and radio, which is called to promote freedom of speech. The President initiated the judicial reform to bring Ukraine's judicial system in line with the European standards. Recently, the draft law on judiciary reform and the judge's status was approved by the Parliament of Ukraine in the first reading. On July 1st, the Verkhovna Rada has adopted the law on the fundamentals of internal and foreign policy that was introduced by the President. This law identifies the key priorities of Ukraine's internal policy, state building, development of local self-governments and regions, development of civil society, national security and defense, as well as economic and social development. Key elements of these reforms it includes changes in security sphere. This law established Ukraine's non-aligned status, which means non-participation of Ukraine in military political alliances. Priority status of engagement in improvement and development of European collective security system. Continuation of constructive partnership with NATO and other military political blocs, and Ukraine's integration in the European political, economic, and legal framework with the end goal of EU membership. Now I'll turn to key elements of economic reforms as it's seen by the President. The global financial crisis has considerable negative impact on Ukraine's economy. Coping with its dire consequences is a serious challenge that we face. The President has initiated systemic reforms that will turn around the situation, will make Ukraine again an economic growth leader, and bring prosperity to the people. To help this process, the President has established the Committee on Economic Reforms that serves as an advisory body on reform strategy and specific tactics. On June 2nd, the Economic Reforms Program named Prosperous Society, Competitive Economy and Effective State was presented. Improvement of business climate, modernization of infrastructure, development of the human and social capital, increasing government efficiency are among key elements of economic growth. The reforms will strengthen the civil society and the rule of law, raise responsibility of the government at all levels, and will increase the well-being of the people. The President pursues the policy of comprehensive reforms and systemic modernization of the country, which covers a wide range of spheres and issues. Outlines of the results of this reform. It will result in macroeconomic stability, rapid economic growth at 7.6 annual GDP growth, agricultural sector overhaul, energy sector development, including exploration of new mineral deposits in western Ukraine, raising living standards and substantial improvement of healthcare. President Yanukovych defines the following vectors of economic policy as the most crucial one. First element is sustainable economic growth, which requires comprehensive measures aimed at stabilization of the state budget, tax reform, accelerated development of the financial sector, reform of inter-budgetary relations. The purpose of public finance reform is strengthening of relationship between the fiscal and social and economic policy of the state. Second is social services upgrade, which includes pension system reform, strengthening social safety net framework, and overcoming poverty. Third is improvement of business climate and investment policy. It is planned to reform the regulatory system, to complete the licensing system reform, to decrease the number of permits, to streamline the system of state supervision and control, in particular cut the number of supervisory bodies. The purpose of the reforms in this sphere is to establish clear and transparent rules of the game to be observed by everyone, regardless of political affiliation and other affiliation. Modernization of infrastructure and reforming of core sectors of the economy is the last key element of this package. It means housing and municipal sector, the fuel and energy sector, transport infrastructure, agriculture. I would like to tell you some key indicators which characterize our economic situation. Due to the immediate crisis management measures, Ukrainian economy is showing first signs of recovery. In April this year, for the first time since 2006, deflation accounted 0.3%. The GDP in the first 5 months of the year increased by 6.1% comparing with the same period of last year. During January and May, the industrial output went up by 12.6%. The export turnover increased by almost 30%. In this line, the president and the government of Ukraine are further actively cooperating with the International Monetary Fund and other international financial institutions. This is critically important for success of reforms in Ukraine's advancement. On July 3rd, the IMF mission finished their visit to Kyiv, and a staff-level agreement on economic policy programs that can be supported with a 2.5-year, $14.9 billion US dollars standby arrangement was reached. We expect on July 28th the meeting of the executive board of the IMF, which will finally approve this agreement. I will shortly outline foreign policy priorities as one of the elements of the President Yanukovych policy. His perspective of Ukraine's national interests in foreign policy dimension is based on pragmatic understanding of the existing realities. Among Ukraine's key foreign policy priorities is reiteration of our course towards European integration, development of strategic partnership with the United States and Russia. We are interested in success of the reset of Russian economic relations as well, and are confident that Ukraine and the region will benefit from it. The development of good neighbor and mutually beneficial relations with Russian Federation in all spheres, including energy sector, is a priority. Ukraine considers Russia as a strategic partner. Improved Ukrainian-Russian relations will result in increased stability in the region and the world. On this, I will finish my remarks. My colleague Andrei Fialka will elaborate more on foreign policy priorities. And on this, I would like to thank you, and I'll be happy to hear your questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Evgen. Nadia, I mean, obviously, the Ukrainian government has set up quite an ambitious agenda for reforms, and we had a long list there of various domestic priorities. You've just quite recently been in Ukraine. How do things look from your vantage point?
Yes, I agree that that sounds, some of what Yevhen told us sounds very rosy, and I'm glad that the president is making statements about freedom of speech and so on. But that seems to be the view from the top. Maybe I can present a little bit of the view from the grassroots, because that's right. I did spend a couple of weeks in Ukraine just very recently. So I was here, I was talking to a lot of people, I was talking to a lot of civil society activists, talking to some politicians, more opposition politicians than people in government who didn't seem to always be available when I wanted to speak with them. So my presentation will have a slightly different tone and flavor, I think. But I'd, because there is this sort of general sense that also has that has pervaded our space here across the ocean, that Ukraine somehow is going backwards. So I'd just like to start this presentation with a very dramatic declaration from Andriy Shevchenko, a member of parliament from the Bute faction, that any of you who watch Channel 5 probably will have seen it, where he's standing at the podium in the parliament saying, one incident, he calls it situatsiya, is a misunderstanding. Two incidents is an unfortunate set of coincidences. Three incidents, that is a tendency. Four, this is beginning to look like a system. I can't deliver it as dramatically as he does. But I think this sort of sums up the way people are thinking, that there are a lot of there are a lot of things going on that seem to indicate that Ukraine is rolling back, but no one has quite, no one is quite ready to say that this is a system. So I believe Ukraine is somewhere in between three incidents, that's a tendency, and four, it's beginning to look like a system. So between third and fourth base, that's not yet a home run as far as I can, if I can use some terminology I'm not very familiar with.
But, you should have stuck to soccer.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, you've got to kind of take after the, you know, follow the motherland.
Yeah.
But let's take a look at the record so far. On governance, the government, oh, by the way, as well, I think in terms of elections, there's no one who is disputing that President Yanukovych won the elections. Only by 3-point-something points, but that it was a free and fair election, and I think that not even the most radical opposition people are disputing that. But let's take a look at the record so far. On governance, the government is mainly appointments from the Kuchma times, with just a couple of exceptions, notably Serhiy Tikhipko. It's 29 people, or actually 27 people at last count, since two have resigned or been pushed out. And it's hard to see how they can be effective as a team. And at least two of them, Tsushko on economics and Yaroshenko on finance, are not noted particularly for their expertise. So we must assume that the economic policy is being made elsewhere, not in the government. And then there was the Prime Minister Azarov's sort of slightly chilling assertion a few weeks ago about the rapid anticipated success in constructing a vertical of power, which is a phrase that I think we haven't heard in Ukraine for a long time. Then the Verkhovna Rada, the parliament, where, according to everyone that I spoke to, there's a process of trying to buy off opposition deputies if this is to be believed, $1 million each for starters and then $25,000 per month. The aim here is to gain the 300 votes that would be controllable votes that would then change the constitution. But I think this looks unlikely in the short term and possibly in the long term as well, although the Rada has already pushed through numerous pieces of legislation without sufficient discussion, like the Black Sea Fleet Accords and most recently the new legislation on local elections, which will be held at the end of October. On the judicial branch, I was hearing about attempts to bring the Constitutional Court under control, and there's been a new appointment. The head of the Constitutional Court is now a person from Donbass, so that's being interpreted as, again, you know, another attempt to exert control over the Constitutional Court and to continue the isolation and downgrading of the Supreme Court, which, if you remember, the Supreme Court was the court in 2004 which gave the decision that made the Yushchenko victory possible. So this is sort of, people are saying, oh, this is just revenge for 2004, but it's also a troubling sign that the judicial branch is not as independent as we would like it to be. On democracy, which is on the minds of many people that I spoke to, A number of incidents suggest that the SBU, the security services of Ukraine, are once more being used to harass and conduct surveillance on potential sources of opposition, not to mention the very controversial role of the head of the SBU, who is at the same time an owner of one of the largest TV channels in Ukraine. That's the channel Inter. On freedom of speech, I think the fact that Andriy Shevchenko, with the phrase, the quote that I gave at the beginning, is that that clip is run on Channel 5 over and over again. So it shows that speech is still free in Ukraine. However, it's quite clear from the protests and the publicity that journalists and editors have come under pressure that that is being that some items are now being sort of collected, and there's a Stop Censure protest group has been formed and is documenting many of these instances. It shows that there is pressure. However, I think that the pressure has been intermittent. It's not as if opposition people can't appear on the TV. It's not as if experts can't appear on the TV. I was watching TV myself, and I can say that the speech is, it's about as free as it has been before in the past. But that doesn't mean to say that that the whole structure of the media industry shouldn't be looked at precisely to try and bring about an independent public television capacity, which I think at the moment is very lacking because the ownership of all of the TV stations is still the same as it was 5 years ago and indeed 7 or 8 years ago. So the owners generally tend to try and keep on good terms with whoever's in power. On freedom of assembly, there was an attempt to pass the law 2450, restricting the right to hold meetings, but I'm not sure whether that was actually passed yet or not. They have to go through several hearings, but there were some attempts. On freedom of religion, the fact that Yanukovych invited only Patriarch Kirill to his inauguration sent a strong signal. This is Patriarch Kirill of the Orthodox Church, Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Moscow Patriarchate. The Moscow Patriarchate. Yes, you're right. That Yanukovych invited only one denomination to his inauguration, in distinction to President Kuchma, who had many of the, there are about 55 different denominations of religions in Ukraine. President Kuchma invited many of them. President Kravchuk did too. But this sends a strong signal about which way things might go in terms of religion. And I have been hearing some information about the Ukrainian Orthodox Church is now trying to take over buildings of the Ukrainian Autocephalous Church. The street next to the Lavra was renamed last week, I believe, from Ivan Mazepa Street to just simply Lavra Street because the Moscow Patriarch folks obviously didn't like to be next to Ivan Mazepa for some strange reason. I don't really know the real reasons behind that, but it was passed by the, you can explain that then. but it was done. I watched it on TV the other day. In education, there's been a reversal, an attempt to reverse the previous administration's introduction of testing, which is actually part of the Bologna process, which is a sort of European set of standards, which Ukraine signed on to in 2005. And there are many people who are concerned that this is a step back. It will mean that Ukrainian students will no longer be able to be accredited in West European universities. The interpreted rollback in education also includes the reduction of education from 12 to 11 years. There are some attempts to justify that 11 years will be just as good as the 12 years, but again, that's creating a debate which the people who are seeing rollbacks will are pointing to that as a problem. There have been suggestions that textbooks should be rewritten together with Russian pedagogical specialists. And then there's the Minister of Education himself, who is all for reducing the use of Ukrainian language in schools, is openly anti-Ukrainian, and so on, which is kind of odd for someone who doesn't have any children. But the Father Gudziak scandal also suggests that visits of the SBU to rectors of the university are routine, and moreover, there are messages being sent out now that the local elections should be a topic for discussion by the rectors. So this is something Father Gudziak actually showed me in a communication he received. Other troubling items that civil society groups were bringing up, the Hromadsky Rady, that is the citizens' councils that were advising the ministries, apparently are either not being convened or are being closed or in some cases just reconstituted to be something different. There's concerns that the new tax code will be particularly difficult for small and medium business as, the author of the tax code, Mr. Azarov, was not known for his support of small and medium business the last time he was in charge of all of this. The tax police are being beefed up despite requests from former government officials like Anatoly Hrysenko to simply disband them. I mean, they could take a leaf out of the Georgian book, and where the road police were just simply dissolved. So all of this, however, I think doesn't amount to a system, but that's where I actually see that there is a danger, because it looks as if the first 100 days or so of Yanukovych have been guided more by being not Yushchenko than by some sort of well-thought-out and solid vision of where Ukraine is going. So, hence the numerous meetings with Russian officials, the sudden flurry of opposition people being arrests of people connected to the gas issues and the customs officials. And it seems as if decisions and important issues in Ukraine's domestic policy are being decided almost on a whim, without discussion, certainly without any attempt to gain public support, and without any thought or consideration of national interests or vision for Ukraine. For example, the Black Sea Fleet Accords, also the decision to hand over enriched uranium, which is very good for this country, but I got a very ambivalent response from Ukrainians when I asked them about this just recently. So just to sum up, politics in Ukraine at the moment seems to be reflecting the values, mentality, and attitude of a sort of Donbass tendency, which is a very different culture from the Western-oriented, steeped-in-history outlook of Viktor Yushchenko. It is a little bit of a clash of cultures. And there is a danger that without policies that have some public input, laws will be passed that will make some things irreversible, particularly if they involve the sale of Ukrainian assets in the area of energy or agriculture, for example, to Russian business interests, which I don't believe would be a good sign for future democratization of Ukraine. So I'll just leave it at that, I think.
Thank you, Nadia. Adrian, how does this look from your perspective?
It looks a little bit different, and I'll try to explain why. I might title my talk "Through a Glass Half Full with Some Visibility" rather than "Through a Glass Darkly." During her visit to the U.S., Secretary Clinton gave out two what might seem on the surface contradictory signals. In her meetings with President Yanukovych, she praised him fulsomely for his defense of human rights and commitment to press freedoms. Then in a speech before Kiev students, she stated, "Rhetoric alone does not change behavior. Statements need to be followed up with concrete actions," suggesting the U.S. administration has some concerns and issues of human rights. And I think that she took the right tack. There is good reason the secretary was inconsistent. So too are the signals coming out of Kiev. I think what we're seeing is a new elite coming into place. Some people have come with baggage. That is the baggage of being in opposition for a number of years. Some people are out for revenge. Other people are out to push the country forward. the government is a broad coalition of people who had supported and banded around the Party of Regions and around Viktor Yanukovych, but it's a very mixed bag, both good and bad. And I think what we're seeing is the sort of working out of these issues as directions are being shaped. And therefore, it is quite surprising to hear very categorical statements about where Ukraine is and where Ukraine is headed. I think it is absolutely, we have heard that Ukraine is moving towards the consolidation of dictatorship, that it is moving on attack, well, it will be a vassal state of Russia. We have heard this is a group of troglodytic, backward, anti-reformers, et cetera, et cetera. But the messages are kind of contradictory. Yes, there are plenty of individual acts, maybe even things that could be called tendencies, as Nadia correctly pointed out. But they do not, in my view, constitute a rollback on human rights. They do not constitute backward economic policies, at least to judge by the decision or at least the tentative agreement of the IMF that Ukraine has made enough steps in fixing its budgetary and fiscal processes to countenance the reopening of assistance. So let me sort of take, and then, of course, there are these issues of censorship, political persecution that is alleged in the cases of two former members of Yulia Tymoshenko's government, Ihor Didenko and the former head of the Customs Service. But as I say, the case is a little bit less clear-cut. One thing that we do have to keep in mind is that there is some degree of policy cohesion that has been substantially welcomed. Now, policy cohesion is not an endpoint in and of itself, but it is a mechanism towards achieving certain vectors and certain directions. And I think that the Ukrainian public is responding after 5 years of constant political infighting, is responding quite positively to these, as trust ratings of President Yanukovych are well above 60%. Trust ratings, not favorability ratings. Now, Mr. Yanukovych has responded to press critics. He has not ignored them. This is not Putinism, where there was a constant assault on media. There have been no legal procedures to strip owners of their holdings. There have been no attacks by the tax police to kind of defund opposition TV stations. People who are alleging that this is a repetition of the Putin pattern of consolidation of authoritarian power should take a look at how it was occurring in Russia and compare all of these kinds of steps. Putin didn't go around apologizing and criticizing some steps that have been taken at lower levels by representatives of his government. I think that sends, at least, if you don't agree that it sends a positive signal, at least it sends a more mixed signal that the country is not categorically headed in the wrong direction. The security service did send some low-level person who had a conversation with the rector of the Ukrainian Catholic University. And then the head of the security service came to clear the air and visited Lviv for the purpose of somehow backtracking on this step. That suggests to me a very different picture than what was occurring during the Putin times, where civil society got no explanations, no contact, whatever. Television journalists are right to say that there's a lot of happy talk on Ukrainian television, primarily on the news. News programs have been cut back. There's less of a kind of a focus on the negative, and the news segments have been substantially reduced in many of the stations that are not news focused. But you have, on balance, also these very popular primetime multi-hour talk shows, 3 hours, which continue to attract reasonably high ratings on all the major channels. They're there on Friday nights. That's what Friday night entertainment is in Ukraine, is, and where the opposition is highly prominent, where the issues are, I would say, hard-hitting, and where there is a broad diversity of views. Now, the main complaints that have been leveled in terms of media freedoms are the same kinds of complaints that could have been leveled a year ago or 2 years ago. That is to say that there are owners, that the owners who run these television enterprises recognize them not necessarily to be profit-making entities, They recognize them to be political capital, and very often in their efforts to extract concessions or build relationships with the government or whatever center of power, they play certain kinds of political games. That was the case with Channel 1 plus 1 under Mr. Kolomoisky, the oligarch, who had about three different positions when there were three different centers of power. And now it's a little more, there's one center of power, so the media, through their owners, often do have this kind of a slant. But to say that it is a system, to say that it is coming from the presidential administration, rather than to say that it is a set of problems that need monitoring, addressing, and intercession, are two very different things. Now, there are a lot of inexplicable things, like the detention of Nico Longa, which to my mind was a destructive act and was resolved very quickly, as I understand it, through the very rapid efforts of the presidential administration to change whatever had happened at the border to this representative of the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. It was completely counterproductive because he was held at the Ukrainian border for 10 hours upon a return from a trip overseas. He is one of the five key people shaping German policy towards Ukraine, and this was a month and a half or 2 months before the likely visit of President Yanukovych to meet Angela Merkel, who gets her opinions about Ukraine from one Nico Longa. So whoever was doing this in a very destructive way. And it certainly, given the fact that it was resolved very quickly, it doesn't, to my mind, constitute itself as some kind of a crackdown on foreign NGOs and the like. Now, there are the questions of two arrests of members of the previous administration, Ihor Didenko and the former head of the Customs Service, by the security forces, under charges of either illegal activities related to the famous 11 billion cubic meters of gas that was held by Rosukrenergo and was transferred to the Ukrainian state upon the payment by the state to Russia of $1.7 billion. But one thing that also should be kept in mind is that there is an equally vigorous anti-corruption campaign going on against people that hit closer to home. That is to say, a member of the presidential administration, admittedly a low to mid-level functionary, was just nabbed in a ring to try to collect money for, gaining favors. Minister of the Interior of Sumska Oblast, just appointed by the Yanukovych regime, was also caught in an anti-corruption scheme, as are allegations against the Deputy Minister of the Interior, who was part of the governing coalition. Similarly, if any of you have been following Ukrainian news, you'll see that in the last 3 weeks there have been a series of raids, investigations, attachments of information regarding land and property issues in the Kiev city administration, which is notoriously known to have been among the most corrupt municipalities, or alleged to be among the most corrupt municipalities in the world. Mr. Chernovetsky, the mayor, has been removed from any control over the fiscal authority of the city. A first deputy mayor has been put in charge of the flows of capital, and serious investigations against a political movement that backed Mr. Yanukovych in the election. It seems to me that those kinds of things also have to be factored in to our views about what is occurring. Nor does the warming of relations with Russia, in my view, signal, although one may disagree how the vote, and I do disagree how rapidly the vote was taken on the ratification of the agreement on the Black Sea Fleet, which would have presumably passed anyway, but it should have been done within the mechanisms prescribed by the law. Nevertheless, there have been a lot of economic discussions between Ukraine and Russia. On balance, I think it's also clear that this new government is looking to balance, to defend sovereignty. They've turned down some suggestions and some agreements that have struck them as being inimical to national interest. They've interceded in the case recently of a corporate raid by Russian economic interests that were also viewed as inimical to the Ukrainian state, and that steel mill raid was reversed. There is a very aggressive plan of travel to Europe and to East Asia by the president, also in search of new markets and new capital. So where I will say is, what does this mean for Western policy? I think for Western policy, it means that we've got things to be worried about in Ukraine, things to work with in Ukraine, people we can work with in Ukraine inside the administration, inside the presidential administration, inside the government, and people that, you know, kind of bear watching. But it just seems to me that a nuanced policy, one that reaches out, one that tries to constructively promote a deeper U.S. and European engagement once the IMF funding is back on track, that tries to deepen the level of economic investment in the country. Those kinds of things are good for diversification. And also to lay out a track for Ukraine, and also not to shy away from criticism, because, you know, as I say, I do think there are serious issues, there are serious problems with how the Ministry of the Interior treats protesters and demonstrators that need correction. There are serious problems. There is a potential danger that an anti-corruption campaign may turn into a politically a politicized anti-corruption campaign. All those kinds of things should be kept in mind. At the same time, I think we should, on balance, understand that, you know, Ukraine is just as the people who are claiming that Ukraine is somehow irrevocably in the direction of Russia and dictatorship are going to be proven just as wrong as those of us, myself included, who believed that Ukraine was irrevocably on the path of a reformist liberal economy with a perfectly functioning democracy and deeply integrated into Western institutions after the Orange Revolution. I think we have to watch out that our caricatures and our our superficial understandings of some of the deeper forces that are active in Ukraine, the role of civil society, the role of political parties, the substantial pluralism that exists in that system. Therefore, I would say that Ukraine will remain murky. It will move, I would say more generally, the tendency will be to move in a democratic direction and pursue a balanced foreign policy but with the aim of deeper integration into Europe.
Thank you, Adrian. And you provided a perfect segue into what we were going to ask Sam to focus on, which is how do things look, certainly from this vantage point, about Ukraine's foreign policy? Do you think things seem as balanced as Adrian is suggesting, or where do you see Ukrainian foreign policy based on the domestic underpinnings?
Well, first of all, thank you, Fiona, and to Steve for having me here. Can I ask you, Adrian, to... Thanks. I have indeed been asked to speak about Ukraine's foreign policy and specifically where I think it's going under the new Yanukovych administration. I'll divide my talk into three parts. First, I'll engage in what I think is one of Washington's favorite pastimes and make a couple of predictions. Second, I'll discuss what I think are four key pathologies of Ukrainian foreign policy, which are often overlooked here or even ignored, I think because they represent continuities between the Yushchenko and Yanukovych presidencies, and they don't fit into our narrative of Ukraine as being either pro-Western or pro-Russian. And finally, I'm going to briefly tell you why I don't think what I'm about to say is particularly important. Although perhaps I shouldn't have admitted that up front. But I think it's important to set the stage. There is a reason why we are asking this question, and it's not just because of Secretary Clinton's recent visit or because no one wants to be outside on a day like today. It is, to be frank, the breathtaking speed with which President Yanukovych has improved relations with Russia since his inauguration. We have the Kharkiv Accords, which, of course, lowered the price Ukraine pays for natural gas imports in return for an at least 25-year extension of the Russian Black Sea Fleet's presence on Ukrainian soil. But these were just the beginning. To give a few more examples, during President Medvedev's visit to Kiev in May. He signed 9 agreements with President Yanukovych, including everything from, on the one hand, a joint statement giving Ukraine's endorsement of Medvedev's proposal for a European security treaty, which had long ago been declared dead on arrival by the United States and most NATO member states, to an accord on bilateral development of Russia's GLONASS navigation system, which is the Russian alternative to GPS. Russian intelligence, although in this case the FSB and not our good friends in the SVR, who we have to thank for Anna Chapman, has returned to Crimea following a bilateral agreement. And some reports indicate that intel cooperation between NATO and the SBU, Ukraine's intelligence agency, have been diminished. Russian firms have made some quite impressive joint ventures with their Ukrainian counterparts, and the frequency of meetings between the two countries' leaderships sometimes leaves you with the impression that Russian officials travel to Kiev as if they're coming to work. On top of all this came the law on the basic parameters of foreign and domestic policy, which was passed on July 1st. This, of course, eliminates the clause on NATO membership being a strategic goal from the law on national security, and states that that a main principle of Ukraine's foreign policy is, and I quote, abiding by the policy of non-blockness, or at least that's sort of my unofficial translation of the Ukrainian pozablokovist, which
underline
and the well, that's a different word, actually. The lack of an English equivalent, though, I think is telling, because even the word block sounds silly to the Western ear in the post-Cold War era. But the message is clear. The leadership in Kiev is no longer interested in seeing Ukraine become a member of the alliance. Well, all of this does represent a change. I am not one of those who ascribe to the narrative that Ukraine is about to be annexed and Yanukovych made governor general of a newly named Malorussia. That's just not in the cards. And the Ukrainian leadership's clear desire to maintain the strategic partnership with the United States, as demonstrated by how it handled Secretary Clinton's visit, and to pursue an association agreement with the European Union, and we just had the EU president in Kiev, are just two of the many reasons why I think that that's just not going to happen. In theory, Yanukovych's goal of simultaneously restoring a functioning relationship with Moscow, with an economic emphasis, while maintaining strategic partnerships with the West, is the right course for his country, it seems to me. In reality, however, and here's my first prediction, I think this is likely to prove impossible. And the reason is not Ukraine fatigue in the West, as some might say, but rather the very different notions of what a functioning Ukraine-Russia relationship means in Moscow and Kiev. For Moscow, this means that Kiev, this implies that Kiev attenuates its ties with the West as part of that process, and particularly with NATO. And just in one example, as the famously soft-spoken Dmitry Rogozin, Russia's ambassador to NATO, put it in an interview just yesterday, very serious, an analysis of Ukraine's annual program for cooperation with NATO shows that there has been no change. In other words, the ambassador continued, the level of cooperation that existed under Yushchenko has been maintained under Yanukovych. I have informed Russia's political leadership about this. One can imagine that he did not do so in an approving tone. Also problematic, I think, is Moscow's insatiable appetite for economic cooperation, to use an inappropriate term. Already last month, Adrian mentioned, this episode where Prime Minister Azarov, who's not known for being tough on Moscow, announced that his government, quote, will not allow a raider takeover of Ilyich Iron and Steelworks, which is a top conglomerate that a mysterious investor rumored to be Russian state-owned Vnesh-Ekonom Bank had sought to take over. In other words, all this is to say is that the honeymoon between Russia and Ukraine that followed Yanukovych's election is doomed, in my humble opinion. And my second prediction is that managing the Russian letdown is going to be the central foreign policy challenge for the Ukrainian government. And it will be a difficult feat to pull off, given how emotionally invested the current Russian leadership is in righting what they see as the wrong of the last 5 years. And I think this also is to say that we should hold off on the hyperventilation about Ukraine's so-called eastward turn. My bet is that the turn, as I've said, has real limitations. And we should also realize that there are other problems in Ukraine's foreign policy that we should be equally, if not more, concerned about. And here are the four pathologies that I'd like to talk about. Again, I think these are continuities as opposed to changes. The first is what I would call the Potemkinization of Ukrainian foreign policy, or Potemkinization, I guess, in English, which is to say that policy often devolves into grandiose but ultimately meaningless declarations with little substance to back it up. This began under Yushchenko, who was famous for his quote-unquote pro-Western policy. In reality, very little of the hard work of integrating Ukraine into Euro-Atlantic structures took place under Yushchenko. Quote-unquote pro-Western declarations never translated into, translated into pro-Western policies, which is another way of, say, substantive reform. At the end of Yushchenko's presidency, Ukraine featured feeble political institutions, a barely touched reform laundry list, and a crippling political infighting. And to a certain extent, the Potemkinization of Ukrainian foreign policy continues today, with, for example, the law on basic principles declaring that, quote, the priority of Ukraine's foreign policy to be, quote, participation in the refinement and development of the European collective security system, a system which, as we know, does not exist and is nowhere near into coming into being. We also see this in the uncontrolled metaphor proliferation coming out of Kiev these days. We have the strategic triangle of the U.S., EU, and Russia, also referred to as the three-legged stool. But most prominently is, of course, the notion of Ukraine being a bridge between East and West. All of these strike me as convenient excuses to avoid the hard work of determining where Ukraine's national interests are and acting on that. A second pathology is what I would call the courtship syndrome. In other words, there's a habit of that is often exhibited of Ukrainians are speaking of their country as a bride to be courted, and the West and Russia as competing suitors. As the codification of Ukraine's non-bloc status indicates, many in Kiev genuinely believe that their country's future will inevitably be decided in that context. This mode of thinking deprives Ukraine of agency as an international actor and can partially explain the passivity with which the relationship with Moscow has been conducted over the past few months. All of the initiatives come from Moscow. Ukraine just reacts. In turn, the question is often asked as to what the West can offer as an alternative, as if we were in some kind of geopolitical bidding war. A third pathology I would identify is the narrow conception of security that has emerged in Ukraine. The majority of the foreign policy establishment seems convinced that the singular key to its survival as a sovereign state is another multilateral security guarantee along the lines of the Budapest Declaration, which was made in the mid-90s when Ukraine gave up its nuclear arsenal. Yet a communique, no matter how elaborate or how often it's repeated, will not address the main threats to Ukraine's security, because those threats, such as corruption, weak institutions, and most importantly, a contested national identity, are of an internal nature. Addressing those problems should be far higher on the priority list than obtaining another piece of paper signed by other countries. The final pathology I wanted to identify is directly related. The competing factions within Ukraine's political elite often pursue their agendas domestically by conflating Ukraine's foreign policy, quote-unquote, orientation with both cultural divides, on the one hand, and the character of the domestic political system. So, for example, on these talk shows that were referenced, often you hear Yanukovych's opponents portray him as Moscow's puppet, an anti-Ukrainian bigot, and an autocrat in the same breath. The supporters of the opposition politicians who make these kind of statements come to see these things as organically related, which, of course, they're not. It may be a good wedge strategy for consolidating a segment of the electorate and winning elections, but this tactic only exacerbates internal divisions which are, in my opinion, Ukraine's gravest security threat, and make nearly impossible maintaining functioning relationships with Russia and the West at the same time. So, why all of that is not very important, despite all the time I put into writing it. I mean to say it's not important in the sense of how the basis we should be making policy in the West on. In short, the answer to the question I was asked to address is simple. As far as the West should be concerned, no matter who is president, Ukraine isn't going anywhere. You know, there are a wide-ranging number of U.S. interests at stake in Ukraine, and these did not change with Yanukovych's election. And not to steal the next panel's thunder, but we should not formulate our policy based on the whims of the leadership in Kiev. This fact certainly explains that we did do that to a certain extent, explains the policy paralysis that set in following the January 2010 elections. Yanukovych's push to improve relations with Moscow rendered our previous approach, which essentially rested on the Euro-Atlantic aspirations of the previous leadership, irrelevant overnight. We need an approach that need not be rethought with each new presidential election because, and I'm happy to say this, Ukraine isn't going anywhere.
Well, I'm not sure where that leaves all of us. I thought it was actually a very interesting allusion you made there to Potemkin, because I think for those of you who are sitting in the audience and who, like me, are Russian history buffs, you may recall that the place for the Potemkin villages was very much on those approaches into Ukraine when General and Prince Potemkin was trying to show Catherine the Great on her grand tour of the rapidly extending empire that Moscow's writ was extending a lot further than it actually was. So this may, in fact, be the segue into the next panel, is all really as it appears. And has Ukraine really gone anywhere since the time of General Potemkin himself, who was readily building false villages all over the place to basically baffle and dazzle people coming by very quickly in carriages, which counts for a lot of us sitting here on, on this panel. I wanted to actually ask Andrei Fialko, who I know is going to be speaking on the next panel, if you have any comments, because, I mean, clearly you have a vested interest in a number of these domestic issues as well as foreign policy. And I was also going to ask our colleague from across the street and, of course, our perpetual colleague, Anders Asland, who's been looking a great deal for a very long time at the Ukrainian economy, whether he might like to share a few perspectives with us as well. As many of you know, Anders has been actively engaged in looking at the issues of Ukrainian reform and, in fact, has a book out with a rather wonderful and provocative title, which I hope all of you are going to run out and buy. And then Anders will provide cookies the next time for us. We're helping with these vast royalties. And then I'll open it up to the rest of you for comments and questions. But Andrei Fialko, please, for some perspectives.
Thank you so much. I'd like to apologize. I'm being severely jet-lagged now, and it may impair my questions and comments. First to Nadia, a short comment. You said that basically the new government is a collection of Kuchma's has-beens, but Tegivka is a bright new star. Tegivka was picked up by President Kuchma as well. And I think that President Kuchma made a lot of good decisions. I mean, he was known for picking up bright people. The first thing. The second thing, I would like to, with all the criticism that he deserves, the question I would like to ask you is that I was kind of intrigued. You were saying that there was little debate on the U.S. proposal to give a highly enriched uranium. Do you mean to say that U.S. meant an indecent proposal to Ukraine? Or this is something to be revisited? Or it's kind of U.S. was pressing Ukraine too hard? Incidentally, there was quite a lot of debate on that. And I'd like to ask Sam as well. I just remembered Mark Twain's famous quip, predictions are difficult, particularly about the future, but diagnosing may not be very easy as well. I do not understand why everyone takes President Yanukovych for declaring that Ukraine would like to be a bridge between the West and the East. Margaret Thatcher, who wasn't known for speaking softly, and who was very firm and who was never soft on Mr. Putin or the Russian leadership, she said that she wants Ukraine ideally to act as a buffer against East and the West. And President Obama's advisors, I think, were advising President more or less within the same lines. So could you please comment, I mean, that he renounces, that he sets aside the issue of Ukraine's membership in NATO to facilitate a reset of relations with Russia. Could you criticize very strongly Mrs. Thatcher and President Obama's advisors as well? Thank you.
Let's ask Anders if you would come in on this, and then we'll go back to the panel. Of course, a buffer and a bridge are somewhat different.
No, I like bridge more.
A bridge does sound better from the Ukrainian perspective than a buffer, particularly when you think of Margaret Thatcher's idea. That is also correct. Anyway, Anders.
Thank you very much, Fiona. And with regard to what Yevgen said here, I don't have any quarrel with anything, but rather a reinforcement on two points. There are two big things that has happened with the Yanukovych government. The first is the presentation of the reform program on the 3rd of June, which is a big reform program of about 85 pages. And by and large, it contains the right things. Of course, such things could always be more detailed, but it's very difficult to quarrel with anything that is there. The question is rather how much of this will be implemented. And the first sign of this that we got was indeed the IMF standby program for 2.5 years, now with $14.9 billion of financing behind it that came on the 3rd of July. There are two substantial prior actions that are required by that program. The first is a new supplementary budget, essentially cutting public expenditure by 1.5%, mainly state subsidies that were introduced during the crisis as anti-crisis measures. And that has been done by the Parliament. And the second measure that is more interesting, it's increased gas prices by 50%, not later than the 15th of July. That's the day after tomorrow. This the government can do without legislation. This is gas prices for consumers and for utilities. I trust it will be done, but of course this is a very good prior action where you can see if it's actually done. And the critical issue is that Ukraine spends massive gas subsidies. Last year, 2.5% of GDP. This year, it's supposed to go down to 1% of GDP. And next year, there should be no such subsidies. And this is not a good way of spending public money, because this is essentially to subsidize the importation of gas from Russia, which is about the most less way you can do to spend money. And for the rest, I do think that we'll see some other reforms, as Yevgen emphasized, the big deregulation. What for, American businessmen complain most about is that the VAT refunds for exporters are not being paid out properly. This is promised in the IMF agreement, but I'm afraid that I have to add once again. So this is another test if this will actually happen. So something has come about here. It remains to be seen how much it will really be. There are some substantial good steps, as Yevgen mentioned, but of course it could be more. Thank you.
Thank you, Anders. Yevgen, perhaps you might like to start with some comments and reactions, also to your fellow panelists.
Some words on economic policy. In context of President Yanukovych's foreign policy. Somebody mentioned earlier, or probably not, but Ukraine continues to pursue really European vector. On May 25th, Ukraine has signed the free trade agreement with EFTA countries, that is Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Iceland. And it's really a good free trade agreement with all the modalities possible, with some minor exceptions. And this is, I believe, a big step in our European integration. The tough negotiations on FTA continues with European Union. And behind all these processes stands our hopes for improvement in Ukrainian economy and Ukrainian program of reforms and Ukrainian investment climate. So that's basically all.
Thank you. Nadia?
Well, I think the question that was addressed to me was about the government. I'm not saying that everyone...
It was a comment. It was about highly enriched uranium. Oh, there was no debate. I said
there was a debate.
Whether the U.S. made an indecent proposal, should we revise it?
Did the U.S. make an indecent
proposal? An indecent proposal to Ukraine?
I can just say that I heard from actually an advisor to Yanukovych that the idea actually came up. How much it was debated, I'm not sure, because no one else I spoke to knew of any debate that went on about it, but that the idea actually was proposed by an American advisor to President Yanukovych as to a good way to distinguish him from all of the other presidents who were in Washington at the time. Take that for what it's worth.
There were two meetings of the National Security
Council. Andrew, perhaps we can get the microphone, because I don't know whether we're picking this up on the screen. Oh, here we are, just behind you here.
My point is, and I spoke about it when we had lunch, that Mr. Yanukovych is no pushover, and he's not going to agree or to play to somebody's likings or dislikings. He will act proceeding from Ukrainian national interests as he perceives it. There were two debates regarding this issue of the National Security Council, and the decision was taken only when the United States has agreed, not that there will be a meeting between the two presidents, but that it will actually compensate Ukraine for this highly enriched uranium being transferred and give some new technologies to work on the lower enriched uranium. So my question is, whether U.S. was really, you said it in a kind of a flavor of all this negative remuneration of what was happening, whether Black Sea Fleet, not enough debate, U.S. proposal, not enough debate, do we have to revisit it, or we should leave it?
Thank you for clarifying that, but my point was that this was not something that was debated broadly by the public. Which, if it was debated in the National Security Council, thank you for clarifying.
Twice. I'm sorry Mr. Kajara didn't know that.
It wasn't Mr.
The issue of the highly enriched uranium, I don't know whether, Steve, you'll touch upon this in the other panel, but I think it gets to the point that many of the panelists are making, that many of these issues look different from the different perspective that you're looking at. The point Nadia was making was about the speed in which, from the Ukrainian grassroots perspective, this decision seemed to be made. I mean, this is clearly a very highly technical issue. And I think that the point that you're making as well is that this offer was made against the backdrop of the nuclear security conference that took place recently here in Washington, D.C., and it's something, as Steve and Bill Taylor, another former ambassador for Ukraine, will remember, that was a big issue on Ukrainian-U.S. agenda, because the U.S. was very keen on this kind of agreement, but it can also look from the outside as if it's something that may favour Russia or other kinds of relationships. And this is, I think what we have here is an issue where we're in a lot of technical issues, and some seem more clearly to be steps in one direction than others, and others appear to be quite murky. So let's just say that the Ukrainian enrichment issue is murky from some perspectives, has a different flavour from the United States point of view, but certainly from the grassroots level of the Ukraine and the opposition, it looked like this happened extraordinarily quickly without a great deal of deliberation, when really a lot of the deliberation was happening here in Washington, D.C., not where people could actually see it taking place in Kiev. Adrian, you also had a little aside at one point that I don't think the rest of the audience heard with Nadia about the Lavra issue, where I heard Nadia say, so you had to explain
I don't want to be pedantic.
This is a technical religious issue
that the Moscow Patriarchate, of which part of the Ukrainian Orthodox community adheres, has an anathema against Mazeppa, which is still standing and has not been revoked by a synod of bishops. And therefore, it is of some dismay to them that the street that crosses past the Lavra. However, as I understand it, part of Mazeppa Street remains, but it is not the area that abuts directly by the Lavra, which has been
destroyed. Well, this is why I wanted to bring it up, because important. It's again the half...
These are very important. And of course, the street half-named the street. And this is less a dispute with Kirill, it's more disputed with Peter the Great, I think, so we should relegate it there. But what I wanted to talk about was not so much that. I wanted to talk about not uranium enrichment, but Ukrainian enrichment, which is to say that I think one of the things that I didn't talk about, and I think it is a fact that Ukraine will have closer, more intimate business and economic and strategic cooperation with Russia. Russia will use these as a beachhead to create greater cultural influence within Ukraine with an aim of greater political influence, both through the economy and through the culture. And I think the weakest link, so to speak, in the current presidential team is a lack of an answer to what is it about Ukraine that should sustain it as an independent state rather than to be part of this common community. There has to be a national identity, a cultural identity, a narrative that is developed by this government, hopefully in cooperation with the opposition, so that there is a consistent national narrative that is a source of stability to Ukraine. Ukraine has had a rich history of resistance, and it's not just the Cossacks of the right bank or Mr. Mazeppa that were resisting, but you had Don Cossacks and Eastern Cossacks also were resistant to the centralization of Peter the Great. There are all sorts of historical traditions. There are all sorts of ways of describing history and culture. And I think that, unfortunately, Mr. Tabachnik, who has polarized rather than to try to find consensus on national identity, is hurting the overall cause. Fair enough, you want to have a closer working relationship with Russia. But you should also understand that there are some risks involved, and one of those risks is sort of cultural to the soft power side of Russian influence. And I think Ukraine has to have a more vigorous development of that dimension.
Very good. Sam?
Thanks. One quick word on the HEU issue before I address the questions that were put to me. I think we're losing the forest for the trees a little bit here. But, I mean, from humanity's perspective, there is no murkiness, right? I mean, how many bombs, thousands of bombs could be made from the material that is going to be given up? 10,000, 20, something? So it's a big deal, right, from the non-proliferation point of view. U.S. interests, Ukrainian interests are all impugned by that perspective, I think, in regard to your questions. Not to channel Tom Friedman, but I think, you know, the fact is that there, in the sense that we used to think of it, there is no East and there is no West anymore when we're talking about Russia. Not to say that Russia is part of the West, but that, you know, we don't need... And on that point, you know, there are no blocks. NATO has an open-door policy, period. So I just want to say that. And also, even if East-West is just a convenient term for Russia and the West.
For Brookings as well.
Okay.
The West.
Right. Yes. No, I mean, I agree that there is a West. I'm just not sure there's an East in this case. We can handle it just fine, thank you. I mean, President Obama... has spoken to President Medvedev so many times that it's sort of an embarrassment for the administration, and they even talk about communicating over Twitter. So we don't, the bridge isn't really it doesn't really present much appeal for either side, I think, of the potential construction. And the third, the question about supportiveness for Ukraine's NATO membership. I might be incorrect, but as far as I have no evidence to suggest that there was any active diminution of that policy with the change in administrations here. I mean, Bill would be in a much better position to comment on that, having been the ambassador through the transition. But I just emphasize that I think that the membership process has always been a demand and capacity-driven one, and not one that is decided inside the Beltway.
Let me take a cluster of questions from the floor here. There's two gentlemen here. Please identify yourself.
My name is Dennis DeSantis from the QED Group. We're international development consultants. Thank you for a very lively and informative discussion. I wanted to ask a particular question of Mr. Burkhardt and also the other panel members. I wonder if you could comment on the administration's position on the moratorium of agricultural land sales and the prospects for either lifting or keeping that in place for the next 6 months to a year.
Thank you. And then there was a gentleman next to you.
Robert Krauss with Quatrex Energy International. And for Mr. Burkhardt, what can be expected in terms of specific steps over the next year or two with respect to reducing energy dependence?
Does anybody else have another question that we could bring here? Have we dazzled you all with our... please, sir.
I'm Armin Tashdinian, just an amateur observer of Ukraine. No one seems to me really touch much upon the tensions between Western Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine, the extent to which these differences affect the foreign policy or any of these developments.
Great. So is West and East still relevant for Ukraine, even if it's not for the rest of us? Mr. Burkhardt, again, two of those questions are very specific to you.
First of all, this moratorium on land sales. There is one of the first key elements of this economic reforms program is the new tax code. Very controversial topic for Ukrainian establishment and Ukrainian economy right now. There was a draft test called it went to presidential administration and it is now under discussion between cabinet ministers, presidential administration, and civil society on basic feature of this test code. It's a very disputable topic. It will be systemic law which, to the understanding of the presidential team, will allow to raise this moratorium on land sales. I will not go into technicalities here, but these two things are very depend on each other. Second question about specific steps on reducing energy dependency. So, as we discussed earlier this week in Washington, first is we have to improve the investment climate so the domestic and foreign investors will come to our energy sector very effectively. And we can actually raise our domestic gas, conventional gas production by 50% in the following year or two. This is only one feature. We also examining our possibilities in extraction of shale gas and other sources of energy. What was the third question?
The other question was about any persistence of east-west tensions. I don't know whether you might want to address this from an economic perspective. This isn't just a cultural issue, but...
On the economic perspective, the question which many raise is whether Ukraine will join or somehow affiliate its economy with the customs union of Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. So our position that we will cooperate with the customs union on the norms and principles of the World Trade Organization, which is well, a very controversial answer, but that is our political position in this debate from the economic perspective.
Nadia.
Maybe I'll just make a comment about the East-West question. The idea that there are these huge tensions between East and West, I think, are very much overplayed, actually, because if you look at a sort of grassroots civil society level, you know, people from the East are constantly now traveling in the West, and people from Lviv don't so often go to places like Donbass and Luhansk. But I think the sort of general level of tolerance is something that should be admired in Ukraine. I think what we should be looking at, though, is the way that the particular types of political culture manifested from the Donbass group and the group that just left power, which is sort of often labeled as the sort of Western-oriented, although, you know, quite how authentic that label is should be a question. But I think that this is the challenge for Ukraine for the coming period. The political elites really need to work out a more democratic political culture that somehow downplays some of these sort of rough edges that the Donbass group is bringing into Kyiv right now, and the people from the former administration need to somehow feed in what their ideas were about sort of traditional Ukrainian historical culture to come up with this futuristic identity of Ukraine, which might be different from what we had in the last 5 years and hopefully will be a little different from what we have now, but would benefit whoever is going to be in power for in the next period.
Adrian.
Again, on the East-West question, I think that on the issue of Ukraine's statehood, I don't think there is a terrible difference or a crisis of identity or confidence. Everybody who is within the territorial configuration of Ukraine pretty much understands that there is a state. It's Ukraine. It's their state. They adhere to it, and to a greater or lesser degree, they have some sense of identity with the state. But I do think that there is a very sharp polarization on the issues of education, on issues of sort of the past of historical identity, of linguistic, ethno-linguistic politics, and the path that was not taken in the rush to constitute quickly a working government and to get the agenda of the country moving after, you know, virtually 18 months or more than that of political deadlock, resulted in one of the options, which was a broader coalition, not being taken. I think it would have been far preferable if it had been some effort to create a legitimate majority, an even more legitimate majority than the Constitutional Court ruled, a majority that would have potentially included our Ukraine and may have had a number of representatives from the alternative elite, because I think that was exactly what happened after the Orange Revolution. In the sort of atmospherics of the victory, it was, you know, the other side and the voices of the East were also cast aside. And today we have sort of the reverse happening, where many of the West Ukrainians are not in the political process, they're not in government, they don't see their representatives in many of the key positions. And so it creates a certain sense of alienation. And the failure of the political elite to kind of figure out how to deal with the losers in a civil way is a constant problem of Ukrainian politics.
Thanks. Sam, final perspective.
That.
You agree with
yeah,
that?
Yeah, 100%.
So East and West still there in Ukraine, but shall the twain meet? Prediction? Okay, we've silenced
only
some.
If it's an effective buffer, I guess.
Right? Not if it's a buffer. Well, I think that we've actually reached exactly 3 o'clock, which is remarkable, unless my watch is fast, as fast as on Kiev time, perhaps, than on Brookings time. We promised everyone a break. I'm not sure if we've had a replenishment of the coffees and cookies, but I would encourage everyone to take a quick break and reconvene here in exactly 3:15. So please all come back again.
About 3 weeks ago, after I visited Ukraine in mid-June, I wrote a piece that went on the Brookings website called Two Narratives on Ukraine. And after having listened to the first panel, I think I came up about two narratives short. But I think what we saw was a very diverse presentation about what's going on in Ukraine and different interpretations about what it means both for Ukraine's domestic policy and also its foreign policy. What we didn't get was a consensus viewpoint, but what we'll try to do in this second panel is talk about how the West should respond. You know, we've seen where Ukraine has gone in the first 3 or 4 months under President Yanukovych. What sorts of things should the United States and Europe do in reaction to that policy? How do we best engage with Ukraine in a way that moves Ukraine in the direction that the West would like to see? And on our panel today, we have 4 very good panelists to address this topic. I won't give detailed biographies because you have them all in the program, but our first speaker is going to be Andrei Fialko, a career diplomat, advisor to the President of Ukraine, picking up on an introduction that was made earlier, a has-been from the Kuchma administration. But I mean that in the positive sense. We actually dealt with each other quite a bit 10 years ago. And although we sometimes disagreed, I think it was a very good conversation, it was a very candid conversation. Second, I'm going to ask Bill Taylor, who's currently the Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations at the U.S. Institute of Peace, to speak. More relevant than his current position, he was from 2006 to 2009 the American ambassador in Ukraine. Prior to that, in the 1990s, he was the coordinator for assistance operations and spent a lot of time in Ukraine. And I've asked him to talk about how he thinks the United States and Europe should engage with Ukraine. Our third panelist is David Kramer. He's a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund, but prior to that was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, where he oversaw issues regarding Ukraine. I've also asked him to talk about how an American looks at the ways in which the United States and Europe should engage in Ukraine. And my hope here is that they will bring slightly different perspectives as opposed to repeating the same viewpoint. It'll make for a more interesting panel. So, David, since you go second, bear that in mind. And then our last speaker is Adam Eberhardt, who's a researcher from Poland. He's currently the deputy director at the Warsaw Center for Eastern Studies. And he'll close by giving us a European perspective on how the West should react to Ukraine. So with that very quick introduction, let me turn the floor to Andrei.
Thank you very much. I hope the backbenchers can hear me. Good. So thank you, Steve, for having me here. Thank you, Brookings, for having this panel. I'd like to say that relations with the United States and with the West, whether right or wrong term, are very important for new Yanukovych administration. And therefore, I think the challenge is for the two sides how to the best of intentions can become the best of practice. But also I would like to speak a little bit in more detail about Yanukovych as the leader and as the president, since there's surprising lot of misinterpretation and I would even say underestimation of his foreign policies. So I understand that foreign policy advisor is not supposed to rubbish the president and he's not supposed to be licking his excessively. I think what he's supposed to do is to say the things he believes in and he wouldn't be ashamed of in 5 or so years. Now, having this in mind, I'd like to ask questions and give answers to them. So, is Yanukovych a strong leader? Is he interested in foreign policy and in relations with the West in particular? Can he deliver? Is he a leader with a very much hands-on approach, who wants to give me bad news first, or he lives in an illusionary world of his own? Now, my answers will be that Yanukovych obviously is a strong leader. He has his agenda, and he's able to carry it out. He is very interested in foreign policy. He is very much result-oriented. He's very much interested in good relations with the U.S. and with Europe. And frankly, I don't understand why people tend to question this. Now, let's go to more specific issues. The problem, and obviously Yanukovych, I think, is a very good president who would defend Ukrainian national interests. The key question is how he defines them. I think along the definitions is that good relations with Russia include a very important element of his understanding of Ukraine's national interests and foreign policy. Having said that, I should like to say that taking into account Russia's legitimate interests are probably this approach shared by most of Ukrainian politicians. The little detail, though, is how do you understand the word legitimate? And here, of course, there may be problems of misinterpretation in Kiev and in Moscow. But Mr. Yanukovych will be happy, obviously, to pursue a policy which will be Ukrainian-based, Ukrainian-centered, result-oriented, and our national interests will determine our obligations now, and not like before, our international obligations determined our national interests. Also, I would like to say that in foreign policy, you can proceed very often, even if you want to. There should be a realistic avenue for proceeding. I mean, if the other side is not ready or is not willing, so there's not much you can really do. In that respect, a lot of attention was being focused on Yanukovych's meetings with Russian officials, and their number was indeed impressive. But again, I would like to ask, and he said to the in his interview to the BBC that he would like to meet as often, for example, President Barroso or President Obama, if I may add for myself. The question I would like to ask the audience and the distinguished panelists, how many meetings can President Yanukovych have with Obama or with Barroso? And because of the obvious answer, does he have to hamper his number of meetings with Russian officials where he can really proceed and do business? I think Ukraine has been wandering too long in three trees, like three strategic partnership, US, EU and Russia. The world is a far bigger picture, and I think you would see a lot of new openings and a lot of results. For example, China is one obvious example. China is very interested in having a strategic partnership with Ukraine, and they are ready to go reasonably far. We are ready to go reasonably far, so I hope this will be a very productive relationship. I think there will be reinforced emphasis in Latin America and the Middle East, Persian Gulf, and probably a number of other emerging markets. Ukraine will reinterpret its place in the former Soviet area, and a lot of Soviet, ex-Soviet republics are actually eagerly awaiting this. Let me now go one again level down and say what can be realistically expected in our relations. First, our relations with the U.S. defined by President Yanukovych as key priority. Very sad truth is that it is an issue where Ukrainian political forces and public opinion would be happy to proceed and would be happy to actually resolve membership issue. But unfortunately, EU is not ready and willing, neither ready nor willing to contemplate this. As you may know, Ukraine is actively engaged in negotiations with the European Union on a new agreement, and the stumbling blocks there in political area are exactly the three things the EU is not willing to address. The first is the issue of prospective membership of Ukraine. I mean, if there's a question where Ukraine is going, give it European perspective. And if it accepts, it's sincere. If it rejects, then it's hypocritical. But unfortunately, our colleagues in Brussels do not want to have such an experiment. So we are insisting so far that keep the option open for European perspective in this agreement, partnership, in this association agreement. Second thing is the duration of the agreement. It may seem a technical issue, but in fact, it's a political issue, because after the expiration of the agreement, Ukraine is eligible to raise the membership issue, which is the next step. And European Union is willing to deprive us of any pretext for doing this. The third thing is liberalizing of visa regime. As you may know, Ukrainians, EU citizens as well as US citizens travel to Ukraine without any restrictions. They just buy a ticket plane, go in there. Well, Ukrainians unfortunately have to go through a very long, humiliating procedure. And I would strongly recommend that those who care about the image of the United States or EU go and attend the long session in the embassies, the long queues. People have to stand there. The inhuman conditions they have to suffer waiting long hours in the embassies. Rooms are very often without air conditioning. And then being rejected the visa applications, having spent so much time and energy. So it's a really very important issue. And unfortunately, it's not been addressed adequately. So when some of the colleagues here in the United States allege that Ukraine is not interested in the European integration, that is simply not true and does not correspond to the reality, because it's Ukraine who pushes the EU to be more open and to be more active vis-à-vis Ukraine. Now, as far as relations with NATO are concerned, it is true, and there's no secret, Yanukovych made a pledge that Ukraine will not be pursuing course to enter into NATO. I don't know why it has been prescribed such an apocalyptical kind of implications, which are no longer there. I mean, some people want to join NATO, the other people do not want to join NATO. It's the decision supported by the people. Why he doesn't want to join NATO? It's not because it's an aggressive bloc. And I agree that non-bloc status is very, I would say, is very weird at best. But it's the shortest possible term. I didn't invent it. So, but again, what is the other way to describe the policy? It's not that Ukraine is not joining only NATO. It's not joining any other organizations. So, but at the same time, it will pursue a course of cooperation and very constructive relations with NATO. And Mr. Rogozin, which was quoted here today, did say, I would say disapprovingly, that the present level of cooperation between Ukraine and NATO is basically alarming. Why does NATO have a problem in Ukraine? People tend to think only that this is a kind of a concession to Russia, which is an oversimplification. Obviously, you cannot have good relations with Russia. This is a sad truth. If you are a post-Soviet country, pursue a pro-NATO course. You may accept it, you may not accept it, but this is the truth. The second thing is that this is only part of the truth, because part of the population of Ukraine is still under the old Soviet stereotypes, reinforced, it is true, when they watch Russian television, and they have a kind of a perception about NATO which does not long correspond to the truth. But most importantly, a lot of population does not want Ukraine to be involved in any out-of-area operations like Afghanistan, and operation in Serbia was very detrimental, particularly to the perception of NATO in Ukraine. So there's a real problem in public perception, and I think Ukraine is not the only one who has to address it. I mean, NATO countries have to address it as well. Besides, and I think it is very important as well, that there's no political party, strong political party, which can advance NATO integration in Ukraine. Yanukovych never campaigned on this. And the ratings of NATO, of those who want to, of the Ukrainian public which support NATO membership, are 5 to 6 times higher than the ratings of the political parties that tend to support NATO membership. So it's not NATO membership, it's not the political parties that support NATO membership, it's NATO membership that supports these political parties. as far as the relations with Russia are concerned, as I said, Yanukovych believes that good relations with Russia are very central. Relations with Russia are seen as having importance per se, and I think he's quite sincere in pursuing them. But again, he will be in a very tough way defend Ukrainian interests. And one of the key tests will be the Southern Stream. As you may know, Russia has a number of ambitious plans to transport energy from Russia and from the Caspian region to Europe, and they all bypass Ukrainian territory. So the question President Yanukovych asked is that if we have new relationship, why all these bypasses? We have to translate it into very specific things. And I think their sense of the relations with Russia in the economic area is to try to find a balance of interests which would allow Ukrainian industry to pick up momentum and to jointly, instead of, for example, our aviation industry, instead of peacefully dying, can have a second birth. Relations with the United States are obviously very important. But again, Ukraine is not the size of Japan in terms of its economy, and one cannot realistically aspire for serious U.S. attention. So that leaves us a question, what will be a constructive U.S. relationship with Ukraine look like? I think that the key is the word partnership. Partnership is a two-way street. With all respect to David, it's not handing out the critical lists of things you have to do this. Sack this official, do this and do this. I think it's far more sophisticated and complicated. And the really important partnership is that to open the markets, to have some important economic projects, joint ventures, and something when the other side has also a say. I can remember a lot of things when Ukraine sacrificed its real economic interests because the United States mostly, but sometimes even European countries were asking us to do so. But I do not remember a single case when a Western country, United States or European Union, would take into account Ukrainian sensitivities. And there are here two American ambassadors on the panel and one very important State Department official. If you remember the case, please correct me. President Yanukovych wrote a letter to President Obama, which we are carrying and hopefully will be delivering tomorrow, in which he said a very important thing, that I set myself an ambitious task that Ukrainian-American strategic partnerships becomes a kind of a national consensus in both countries, that irrespective of who is in power, irrespective of what is geopolitical situation or internal situation, this is a priority to be pursued in both countries by all political parties. And I think that is not a negligible thing. How much time do I have?
That's about time. Good part. You've covered, I think, the basic issues.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, but I have a good...
That's a polite way of saying your time's up.
I have a good quotation.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure I can find it.
Depends on who it's from.
Pardon?
Depends on who it's from.
Last time they quoted you.
I mean, it just... No. It's just, I think the new personal, to sum up, that personal relations must never become a substitute for hard-headed pursuit of national interests, and that's what will happen under Yanukovych. We should adopt a right attitude, neither defiant nor submissive, but calm and friendly. And I hope that's what's about to happen.
Okay. Thank you. Bill.
Andre, the presence of all these people in the room today on a summer afternoon, I think, is testimony to the importance of Ukraine. And in answer to one of your challenges, I can think of a couple of instances, very important instances, where the U.S. administration took the advice of and indeed pushed hard in on behalf of Ukraine. And one of them you won't like too much. But the whole discussion in Bucharest, where the president and the prime minister and the speaker and the foreign minister went to great lengths to get the United States to push very hard for a membership action plan was one that we thought we were doing exactly what you were just asking us to do. We pushed very hard for what you thought, or at least Ukrainian leadership thought, and what we thought was in the Ukrainian interest. It was clearly in the U.S. interest as well. We wouldn't have been doing all that without that. But the main message, you'll get your chance. You'll get your chance. My message is that Ukraine does matter to us. It may not matter in the same way that Iraq or North Korea or Pakistan or Iran matters, but you don't want to be in that category. You don't want to be in that category. You want to be in the category, it seems to me, of where several, indeed all, recent administrations have had Ukraine, and that is as a leader, as a model, as a guide for other countries in the region, around the world as well, but in particular in the region, in the post-Soviet space, in the East European space, where Ukraine has been, and I hope will continue to be, a leader in democratic practices, in democratic principles, in societies that are open and able to speak their minds. I think that is why Ukraine's important. And Ukraine's success is important to people here and around the world, not just because there are 46 million people there. Ukraine's success matters to a greater number than 46 million. Ukraine's success matters to others in the region. I would include, of course, the Moldovans and the Georgians and the, even the Russians. I would think that the Russians have a great stake, maybe not this government, but the Russian people have a great stake in the success of Ukraine. So I think you should be pleased that we put such a high value on your success. We have, and by the way, there's no room, I think, for fatigue. I mean, we're not talking about fatigue here. We're talking about encouraging Ukraine, being interested in Ukraine's success, and continue. And therefore, I disagree, actually, with Sam. Sam thought that point was not important. I think it is important. I think the point that you made, Sam Cherub, was it was important. That is, Ukraine does matter in the overall sense. This is, I think, something that brings us all here today. A couple of questions for Ukraine. And Sam, I agree with this part, so you have to keep listening. The self-conception, the image of Ukraine by Ukrainians, I think, is important. We've said there's a West but no East. I'm not sure that's true. I think there are still decisions to be made. I mean, I think there are European values and there are Eurasian values, and there are decisions to be made institutionally, politically, culturally. There are competing customs unions. You've made a decision on that. That's important. There are competing visions of government and governance in Eurasian societies, countries. There's a very strong president without much opposition and without much check and balance in that structure. There's a European version of that, which has checks and balances, more parliamentary. There's even an American version with a strong president, but with strong checks and balances as well. Those are decisions, and Ukraine has had a direction, has expressed values that go in the more European direction rather than Eurasian. The business of a bridge. I'm not sure that's the right metaphor.
Margaret Thatcher.
Margaret Thatcher may have been wrong on this thing. People walk on bridges. So this is not the metaphor I think that you want. Again, Europeans can. We will hear from Adam. Europeans can have relations with Russians. This is not the issue. The question is whether Ukraine is independent, is sovereign, and that is so valuable that should not be lost. energy. We've talked a lot about energy, and we should talk more about it. But the degree to which Ukraine maintains its independence, such as it can, in, for example, in nuclear energy, there is the opportunity to buy nuclear fuel from people other than Vel, rather than the Russian supplier. And indeed, Ukraine has signed an agreement, a contract with another supplier, a Western supplier, that would give some competition, some opportunity to keep the prices down, put downward pressure on prices, as well as to give an option if the conditions get bad. So I think their gas and oil, you've already talked about the kind of the dependence of that. The direction, the European direction in democratic principles and practices, I think is important for what you say is the strategic direction, and that is toward European institutions and European values. But the democratic character and commitment of Ukraine, I think, will be a strong plus in Europeans' evaluation of Ukraine's place in Europe. What should the Western response be? I think in a sentence, in a phrase, it ought to be the door stays open. The European door should stay open. And I take your point that Europeans don't give you that sense that there's a European prospect at this point. Others will describe European attitudes, but European attitudes change. This is not the last statement, the last answer to Ukraine. There's going to be plenty of time for Ukraine to do things that need to be done in order to qualify, in order to be ready for, in order to be ready to integrate with European institutions on customs and regulations and the whole range of the acquis. There are years to take this. And things change. Attitudes change. European attitudes will change. So I think that open door is important for them, and we can say that. Americans can say that. Europeans are going to have to come in. But Europeans' attitudes will change. NATO, the Secretary of State, has already made the point that the door's open. It's up to Ukrainians. That was the position when I was there. Sam asked whether the position changed when the new administration came in. I stayed there for a couple of months after that, and it didn't change. That's the position then. It's the position now. And I look forward to further conversations about this. Thank you, Steve.
David.
Thanks very much, Steve, to you, Fiona Brookings, for organizing this session. I, too, am incredibly impressed by the turnout here. A hot summer day in July with so many people showing strong interest in Ukraine. It suggests that we actually need to do a few more meetings like this here at Brookings. No, I'm just joking.
Our cookies, huh?
Yeah. I do like your cookies. They are the best cookies in town. But let me pick up on Andriy's challenge, and I agree with Bill citing membership action plan as one to which we responded to Ukraine's requests and interests at the time. Granted, I think interests different from the current government in Ukraine. But there are a couple of others. Jackson Vanek was certainly one. Graduating Ukraine from Jackson Vanek, WTO membership, U.S. support for that, market economy status, all of these things I think were very important. They were in U.S. interest, no question, but they were obviously in Ukraine's interest as well. And I think that was a time when the United States and Ukraine's interest matched up very nicely, and we were able to be responsive and also even proactive in certain issues to try to help Ukraine through its ongoing transition. Coming back to the question that Steve asked me to address about Western policy and hoping that Bill and I would disagree, actually, I don't think we do. But let me try to be a little provocative in any event. For the West, we have to decide whether Ukraine matters. I agree with Bill, the way you described it. I don't think a lot of people in Europe agree with what you said, or, frankly, even in the United States. There is, I think, an unfortunate tendency in Europe and even in certain circles here in the U.S., saying, well, Yanukovych has made his decision. He's decided to go to Russia. Therefore, we can wash our hands and not be bothered with Ukraine anymore. That contentious issue is off the plate. We don't have to deal with that. It won't upset relations with Russia, given how sensitive Ukraine is vis-a-vis Russia. That, to me, is the exact wrong response to what happened in January, February 2010, an election, by the way, which Nadia and I were there to observe, and I stick by the IRI assessment, which was a free and fair election, and Yanukovych won by a little over 3%. We didn't have a great government to deal with in the previous 5 years. In fact, I would argue the previous government was a real failure and a real disappointment. And we may never have an ideal government to work with in Ukraine, but the West needs to decide whether Ukraine matters regardless of which government is in power, regardless of the preferences that the president shows, the prime minister shows, the foreign minister shows. Ukraine, as Bill is, I think, very eloquently saying, matters for a whole host of reasons, not least for the model it can become in the region and Russia. I agree completely, Bill, with what you said. But obviously, most importantly, Ukraine matters for the 46 million people who live inside its borders. We need to show that the West does want to complete the vision of a Europe whole, free, and at peace. I know it's become a cliche. It is still the West's objective, or at least it should be. And Ukraine is a critical piece to that puzzle. And Ukraine, I would argue very strongly, does have a rightful place in the West, in the Euro-Atlantic community, and the West needs to help Ukraine move in that direction. We can't pull it in that direction. We have to help it. And Ukraine, I think, with President Yanukovych's visit to Brussels, his speech in Strasbourg, has said the right things. As you know, I have concerns about some of the actions not matching up with the rhetoric. But he said the right things. Let's remind him of the things he said. And I think Secretary Clinton did a good job of that in Ukraine, although I think her trip was also a missed opportunity in certain respects. And I'll come back to that in a second. The most important policy for the United States, it seems to me, with Ukraine, is to push the EU closer to Ukraine. The EU is what matters to Ukraine. The EU has a lot more things to offer Ukraine than the United States does. But the United States needs to push the Europeans to make sure that they realize the importance of Ukraine and that they stay engaged in Ukraine on free trade agreement, on association agreement, on visa liberalization, agree with all those things. Ukraine obviously has responsibilities to meet the EU halfway or part of the way on that. But the EU has to be serious about that. I agree completely on the importance of maintaining a European perspective for Ukraine, that the door has to stay open. And it is just too easy for the Europeans to say, Ukraine's not interested. We can't take that attitude. And it seems to me the best thing the United States can do is to press the Europeans to stay engaged. I would focus on the EU. I would put NATO aside. Bill's right. It's important to remind everyone that the door stays open. There's no interest at the popular level or at the leadership level in pursuing membership action plan, not to say anything of membership. Though the legislation was passed earlier about military exercises with NATO, that's important to stay engaged. I know some NATO officials are visiting Ukraine this week, in fact, talking about further cooperation with Ukraine in this area. That's important. But let's just not go too far down this NATO road, because it's a issue that isn't going to lend greater cooperation, greater cohesion between Ukraine and the West. On the Secretary's visit. Overall, it was extremely important for her to go. I think it's unfortunate that it was a year since the last cabinet-level official visited Ukraine. Vice President Biden was there exactly a year ago, though I also recognize Ukraine was going through an election campaign and an election, and it made it a little more difficult for senior U.S. officials to visit. The key is to follow up on her visit, and that's where I think we need to test how U.S. policy is unfolding, to make sure there is continued engagement, that this was not a check-the-box exercise, that this was not simply a reassurance visit, that this was a sign of deepening U.S. engagement with Ukraine as well. And I'm heartened that the Secretary pushed the foreign minister on having the next meeting of the bilateral group here in Washington this year, which I think also sends a very important message. Where HEU, I know, was a major issue on the U.S. agenda, very important. I won't go into that anymore. I think the previous panel covered that in plenty of detail. We have to make sure that doesn't become the driving force in the U.S.-Ukrainian agenda, as important as that is. Where I did have some concern about the Secretary's visit is publicly, including in the meeting with civil society, she took President Yanukovych's comments I think, for granted. When, again, if you look at the rhetoric versus what's been happening on a whole range of issues, not least the formation of the coalition, which, even though the Constitutional Court blessed it, I think still is rather controversial. The passage of the Kharkiv deal, the budget in one reading, the postponement of local elections, pressure on journalists, whole range of things. It does seem to me, picking up on what Nadia was saying earlier, that the trends aren't moving in the right direction. It's not irreversible. But these trends, to me, are the most important thing that that is happening right now in Ukraine. The Kharkiv deal, when a new government comes in, can be annulled. And frankly, I think the Russians know that and are planning for that possibility. What is more difficult to reverse are these changes in the democratic development of Ukraine. And I think that should be at the top of the U.S. agenda. And it should be at the top of the agenda with Europeans as well, because this, to me, poses the greatest threat to Ukraine's sovereignty, independence, and democratic development. These shortcomings, to put it generously, if not rollbacks, to put it, I think, a little more bluntly, that we've been seeing on democratic development. There is, of course, the Russia factor. As I said, I'm more concerned about the domestic developments in Ukraine than I am about the heavy tilting. It's not a balancing act, heavy tilting toward Russia. But one can't separate these two, because the Russians clearly are not pressuring Ukraine or pushing Ukraine or cajoling Ukraine to be more democratic or to respect human rights. The Russians, in fact, I would argue, you can tell me if I'm wrong, are saying, this is how to do it. Follow our lead. You want to stay in power, you want to stay in control, you got to control the media, you have to make sure elections are going to be predictable, not unpredictable, a whole host of things. Ukraine isn't necessarily going to follow a Russian model, it's going to follow its own model, but I think there are some bad lessons that the current government in Ukraine might be tempted to learn and follow based on the Russian model, and that's where the relationship with Russia, I think, matters more than anything. Kharkiv deal, as I said, can be undone, but Russian urging that Yanukovych take these steps in order to make sure he stays in power, that to me is more disturbing. I think we have to challenge that. Lastly, the talk about bridges and Sam's point about Ukraine's not going anywhere. Bridges, Bill's right, people walk over them. Bridges also fall apart over time. So I think we do need to come up with a better metaphor, better characterization of this. Just to pick up on Sam's point, because it had me thinking a lot, the Ukraine's not going anywhere. That actually can be going somewhere, because as the rest of the world is moving in a direction and Ukraine's not going anywhere, that means Ukraine is either stuck or is going in a certain direction, and I think that would be a cause of concern. Thanks.
Okay. Adam, your perspective.
Yeah, European perspective. Thank you very much for the invitation. Let me begin by stressing the most important factor, which, in my opinion, has been deeply influencing the relations between the European Union and Ukraine recently. It is a mutual fatigue, I'm afraid. And it has nothing to do with our discussion whether Ukraine matters or not matters, because most of policymakers in Europe would admit that Ukraine really matters, but nevertheless they are quite tired of Ukraine, and I don't see any prospects for the change in visible future. I do share most of the critical comments expressed in the first session of the conference concerning the policy pursued by President Yanukovych and his circle. But let me stress that the very critical perception of Ukraine in the European Union is not only, or even not mainly, the reaction, the response to the government of the Party of Region. The real source of the crisis of confidence in the relation with Ukraine is related to the previous Orange governments, I'm afraid, whether we like it or not. It is quite easy to explain. The higher are the expectations and hopes, the deeper is the disappointment. There is certainly no time and no need to elaborate deeper the outcomes of the policy adopted and not adopted by the recent governments. But let's face the results. Worrying signals coming from Ukraine today seem not to be so much worrying because European policymakers and European public opinion got used to upsetting news arriving from Kiev. Many of my colleagues from European think tanks, from European institutions, expressed their relief that a certain degree of stabilization has been reached under President Yanukovych. It is a very common trend in Europe today, and it is a very worrying trend also, because, well, the most stable country in Eastern Europe is an authoritarian Belarus of President Lukashenko. We should not seek stabilization, and we should not perceive stabilization as the most important value in the region. Everything I said shows how passive and how reactive the European Union strategy towards Ukraine is doomed to be. But as I said at the beginning of my presentation, the fatigue between Ukraine and European Union is mutual. That's true, that the European Union, which has been focused on its ongoing internal crisis, was not able to provide Ukrainians with the offer that would encourage them to go forward with their European and modernization agenda. As a result, the European aspiration of Ukrainian political class have waned, gradually burnt out, and one may have impression for President Yanukovych and his circle, European Union is needed just for two tactical reasons: to get loans from IMF and to balance the influence of Russia. The similar process appeared to some extent in Ukrainian society, I'm afraid. Recent polls suggest and show that over 60% of Ukrainians perceive Russia as the closest and most reliable ally of Ukraine. When it comes to Ukraine, the figure is less than 20. So the closer cooperation and closer integration with Russia becomes more popular, even if not more popular among Ukrainians, at least it gets less controversial. And pro-Russian groups within Ukrainian political elite definitely try to make use of that. Okay, so what can be done in given circumstances where the soft power, the magnetism of the European Union has diminished, and both in among Ukrainian political class and Ukrainian society, and what is equally worrying, where that change is welcomed by European political class. What is the window of opportunity? I think we should not be naive and think that European Union is able to work out a new strategy, ambitious plan to go forward with Ukraine to enhance dialogue and cooperation. It is completely out of the question. We should acknowledge that Ukraine will not be granted a European perspective. We like it or not, it is the reality. The European Union policy towards Ukraine will be pursued by the policy, by the framework of the Eastern Partnership, a program launched by the European Union 1 year ago. I'm certainly aware that Ukrainian politicians, Ukrainian members of international community are quite skeptical about Eastern Partnership. They describe it as quite modest, with not much added value. Well, maybe, but in my opinion, it is high time to take reality into consideration. It is to adjust our expectation to our reality and to make maximum use of the instruments that are available. In my opinion, the added value of Eastern Partnership consists in an additional impulse that it has lent to cooperation between European Union and Eastern neighbors. It was mentioned by David that we should push European Union indirect of Ukraine. I do agree, and it is Eastern Partnership, because it is addressed not only to East European countries. It is addressed mainly to the countries of East European Union to enhance interest in Ukraine and to overcome, to limit the fatigue I was talking about. It already gave some fruits. The Eastern Partnership prevented an imbalanced development of European neighborhood policy in favor of Mediterranean cooperation, which was strongly supported by President Sarkozy of France. There are new challenges to come. European Union is just starting discussion about new financial perspective for the next 7 years, starting from 2013. And Eastern Partnership may serve as a tool to increase the funding. In this perspective, I think the most important is that European Union focus and pay special attention on the projects which are bottom-up, which are driven in a not from the top down, but which include the civil society. It is a civil society forum. It is supporting the small and medium enterprises. The second thing I would like to say is that we not only should make use of the instruments that are available today, but we should also try to shape them in a well-thought way. In fact, there are two cornerstones that should be somehow shaped. One of them is establishment of deep and comprehensive free trade area between European Union and Ukraine, and the second one is further visa facilitation. When it comes to free trade area, we should do our best to convince the decision makers in the European Union that it should be deep and comprehensive, not in name only, that it should include unification of all standards and procedures, but in the very fact it should be beneficial for Ukraine in the sectors which are the most important. I would urge European Union to be as flexible as possible, because this kind of agreement, it is a potential tool of modernization. But it also costs a lot, because Ukraine, which is economy, which is less competitive, needs additional support, additional funding to go through with this program. The second thing that is extremely important is a visa facilitation with the prospect of visa-free regime. European Union should give Ukraine a clear perspective of a visa-free movement, because it will be a very important signal for both Ukrainian political class and for Ukrainian society. We don't have much carrot for Ukraine, so this is the only one, or one of the only one. I think that visa-free regime is one of very few tools to reinforce the European Union soft power among Ukrainians. But the very first step should be to offer Ukrainians a roadmap, a list of a very clear requirements, with the European Union commitment that we will lift the travel barriers just in a day Ukrainians meet the criteria. Certainly, we should be aware about very deep divisions among European Union states. There are also very deep divisions among political class in the states. There are also divisions among the governments of the states, with the foreign ministers being usually good guys, much more eager and willing to go forward with visa-free regime, while interior ministers are usually much more reluctant bad guys. But we should do our best to attract Ukraine as Ukrainian society in this way. Okay, not much time, so let me conclude. First of all, there is a mutual fatigue between European Union and Ukraine, with the European Union soft power diminishing. The second point I wanted to stress is that European Union policy vis-à-vis Ukraine is doomed to be passive and reactive, we like it or not. So what we should do is to adjust expectation and make use of instruments that are available. Focus on step-by-step approach. Support civil society, grant visa-free regime perspective, and be very flexible and supportive in economic approximation between European Union and Ukraine, including establishment of free trade area. All other aspects, political dialogue, security, energy, NATO, it should be strict. We should stick to conditionality because it is up to President Yanukovych and to the people of Ukraine to decide which model of development they choose, whether they prefer a post-Soviet model of development or a European Union one. Thanks.
Thank you. Let me toss out the first question because I think I heard both Bill and David saying that it will be important, or one thing that the United States should be doing is pushing the European Union to pick up some of the slack, because if NATO membership is off the table, which I think it clearly is during this the Yanukovych administration, if you're going to have European engagement, the burden now is with the European Union. But if you do have in Europe Ukraine fatigue, if you do have a reluctance to go very far, and there's a second question, which is how much will the European Union listen to the United States on this issue? In the past, we've suggested that they accelerate relations with Turkey with, I think, not particularly beneficial effect. So where does that leave Western policy? And then, Andre, what does it mean for Ukraine? Because to the extent that Ukraine wants to have balance in its relationship between Russia and the West, you know, if the Western institutions are, for whatever reasons, not engaging, how much of that is of a concern is that in Kyiv? Sure. That was a question actually for all four of you.
Okay, I'll be happy to start because I've marked more or less the same points. The first, and again, I'd like to apologize for my being jet-lagged and maybe not expressing myself clearly enough. So I just want to emphasize that I want to be friendly, constructive, and positive.
We all are. We welcome this approach.
Having said this...
Well, you must be jet-lagged.
Having said this, when people say in the West, we are very tired of Ukraine and there's a fatigue. I mean, tired is when something has been working very hard or have been doing something. My question is, what exactly have you been doing to be so tired? And the other unfortunate thing is that there's a fatigue in Ukraine because the expectations were raised so high by the previous governments that unfortunately people were not able to deliver. And obviously the raised expectations and then disillusionment when there was no chance, in fact, to achieve something. The public was told that it's a matter of days, weeks, maybe month, maybe by the end of the year. And unfortunately this was not happening. But again, my point is, basic message is that United States and European Union should match their rhetoric with their resources and with their deeds. Now, again, as an example, I'd like to use some of the David Strong language, which is very good language I liked immensely. All of the stops on the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's upcoming trip to Europe, none is more important than Ukraine. Ukraine is critical to advancing a vision of Europe whole, free, and at peace. And about Ukraine and is serious about the prospect... I mean, after having made such an important statement, I mean, what's the answer? If the problem is really so important, what's the answer? The Eastern Partnership, and I think the privilege of these conferences is that you can speak off the record, or at least you can speak part of the things that you think, is completely impotent. And I don't want to be just a friendly and positive, I remind you. Yeah. The number of resources it offers to Ukraine approximately is the same, I mean, financial, that Ukraine would have gotten if it kept visa regime with the U.S. So more or less the money we collected for visas is what the U.S. given us within this five-year period. But we were polite enough and I wrote a lot of speeches in praise of it. But frankly, that's not an answer to our problems. So matching rhetoric with deeds means that not inventing another strategy, another useless piece of paper, or not signing to a ringing declaration, but coming up with something that would match the level of problems that we have. For example, EU cannot offer prospective membership to Ukraine, but what it can and I think should offer, something between what is it offering now and what it has offered to the acceding countries in terms of help of approximatization of legislation. far more concerted effort, far more resources, and resulted to reintroduction. Not just sets of rules, we support this, we support that, and we strongly support after all these declarations. So as far as Mrs. Thatcher is concerned and the bridge, I hate the concept of the bridge, I should say. Yeah. The reason I was quoting Mrs. Thatcher, and I like it very much indeed, is that when Mr. Yanukovych says something, it's been taken as something, either he's been weak and soft because of the Russia concerns or something, or it's detrimental to the Western interests. But Mrs. Thatcher is someone who defended Western interests very vigorously, and she believed in that. Mr. Obama's, I think, advisors were making more or less the same advice, and as far as the NATO membership is concerned. So I wouldn't like to accept this point of view that if Yanukovych said this, that this is, he's taken the country in the wrong direction or something. Because there were voices like this in the West. And I personally believe that NATO membership is a course to be pursued by Ukraine, but it has to be Ukrainian people who decide and political party who defend it. You mentioned the letter that we were asking. You remember the embarrassment when I could hardly think of something more terrible to Ukraine-NATO relations than this happening, that Ukrainian public knows about the intention to submit an application for MAP from a U.S. senator who is giving a press conference.
What better source?
Yes, what right? better source? Right. And it also reconfirmed these psychophrenic fears that U.S. is plotting to drag us something or whatever. And the good thing was that the Secretary General of NATO knew about this from the Internet before the letter reached him. And he was very angry with this. But unfortunately, he was very polite in making his anger public, because otherwise it would have proved that there's no kind of design to drag Ukraine somewhere. And the Jackson-Vanik WTO, frankly, Jackson-Vanik is a shame, with all respect. Ukraine should have been granted this status long before. There was the whole thing dragged so much. Is not a good example. My question was, I don't doubt that we have a very serious, productive, and substantive relationship. And the point of my question is whether the U.S. or EU have sacrificed their economic interests or political interests when they were of one opinion, and because Ukraine needed something desperately, they changed it. Indeed, U.S. was very supportive, and we are very reconnaissant for this support, when it broadly, as you yourself said, corresponded to the U.S. interests. And as you yourself correctly said, if it didn't correspond to the U.S. interests, it wouldn't have done it. Now, I want to be Ukrainian politics as pragmatic as that.
Can I jump in?
Go ahead.
We're not looking to join Ukraine. Ukraine, as far as I can tell, is looking to join parts of the European system, which suggests to me that the onus is on Ukraine to meet the requirements necessary for membership, whether in the EU, whenever it may be, NATO, which is not going to happen for quite a while. So I agree with you on Jackson-Vanik. I mean, I support graduation for Russia from Jackson-Vanik. But given the option to either have Jackson-Vanik stay in place or graduate it, I think it was a good thing we graduated. I wish we would do the same on Moldova, which seems to have fallen through the cracks. The point, it seems to me, coming to what Adam was saying, and I think you did describe the reality, we need to change the reality. That's the point. You used the word doomed. We shouldn't be doomed to anything. We either have to decide Ukraine matters, and we have to step up to the plate, whatever that means, the rhetoric, support, all of that, but get serious about completing visa liberalization, free trade, association. Once you get those things done, I don't see how the EU cannot talk about perspective of membership one day. That certainly moves Ukraine closer to the goal line. And so it does seem to me that the United States does need to keep pushing. But it also means that there is a burden on Ukraine to continue to move in the right direction. But the best thing the EU has going for it is that countries on the outside want to join it. I know the EU has lots of problems with current members, but the EU's big attraction is that other countries want to be part of it. And once the EU stops to appreciate that, then I think the EU is stuck. I say that coming from an organization that promotes transatlantic relations.
But I think it does point up the thing that for Ukraine's foreign policy, it turns so heavily on decisions about what happens internally. I mean, if Ukraine Absolutely. Continues on the democratic side, market change, that makes, to the extent that Ukraine moves and becomes more compatible with European standards, that moves Ukraine towards that. And that would be, I mean, to get to your point about, you know, U.S.-Ukraine relations, I mean, it does seem to me that I think the biggest disappointment I found when I was there, and Bill and David can talk about, you know, their views, was that the economics of the relationship between the United States and Ukraine never really gelled. And I always used to talk to my counterpart in Warsaw, you know, and he was always going off to open up, you know, billion-dollar investment deals, and I would have a $50 million American investment deal, and that was a big thing. But that gets to that's something where I think the U.S. government can do some things to encourage, but ultimately that'll depend upon, you know, the situation that Ukraine, within Ukraine. The U.S. government really can't push investors in. But that would, I think, begin to really be a breakthrough in terms of creating a relationship that could be markedly different. If you begin to have trade and investment flows between the two countries reflecting the actual size of the economies.
Thank God we don't have a Gazprom here to be able to tell, go invest, or cut off gas, or any of those kinds of things. Your point is absolutely right, Steve. I mean, the U.S. government can't tell the private sector to go invest in Ukraine. Russia can. Private sector is a loose term. But, I mean, the American companies will go where they feel they can make a profit, and that governments and their counterparts in the private sector play by the rules. And that's up to Ukraine to create those conditions.
And that gets back to one final comment, then we'll open up to questions. We do plan to take questions here. The cohesiveness of the policy. I think actually there is one thing that the Yanukovych administration has, which its predecessor did not have, is there's cohesive policy. The question is, if you take that cohesive now, what do you turn it to? If you turn it to the right direction, I think you can achieve some very important things.
There's very strong consensus on this one.
Okay.
Well, I would like to answer the question of Andrea, although it was already to some extent answered by David. You asked me what is the European Union tired of. I would say European Union is tired of enlargement, with 9 Central European countries being able to meet the criteria and get to the European Union. And right now, European Union has to digest the new situation. But European Union is also, when it comes to Ukraine, quite tired of excessive expectations formulated by different Ukrainian governments, which had been deeply unrealistic and which did not correspond to the condition of the Ukrainian state. And it is the problem. I do acknowledge powerful engine of membership perspective. I do come from Poland, where the political class is much less tired of Ukraine than anywhere in Europe. But it is quite difficult for me to discuss with my colleagues and friends in European Union who say that if we grant Ukraine a membership perspective, it would be perceived as a price for not conducting the reforms. And it is the one problem. And the second problem, which some European Union experts and policymakers say, is that European integration had been used in Ukraine to serve as a useful slogan in a domestic politics. We cannot exclude that after granting a membership perspective, the Ukrainian government will say, okay, that's all. We succeeded. We may sell it to the public as a success. I think that the most important decision by Ukrainians to be made is whether to decide to go in the direction of European Union, the Western model of development, or to stay at the post-Soviet model of development. if the decision of Ukraine would be made according to the decision of European Union whether to provide Ukrainians with one declaration, it would be very worrying.
Okay, let's open up the floor. Okay, let me take three questions here. If you could please wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and keep the question short.
I'll try. Nadia McConnell, U.S. Ukraine Foundation. Last fall, actually right on that stage, Foreign Minister Radek Sikorsky was discussing the Eastern Partnership. And I was really somewhat dismayed, though he didn't specify Ukraine, but one of his comments, the way I interpreted, that there are some countries that have a sort of sense of entitlement that they should be members of the EU without being willing to pass the 1,600 pieces of legislation that need to be passed. I was a little discouraged because that was the first time I heard something, maybe it's called Ukraine fatigue, from the Polish side. And while I am part of the bloc that is concerned about the lack of deep U.S. and EU involvement in Ukraine, but also is there this issue of what is Ukraine doing to become a member of the EU? And also on the investment. I mean, we've been hearing for the last 15 years Ukraine wants investment. But Ukraine's ranking is 142 out of 183 on the ease of doing business. And President Yanukovych has stated that he wants Ukraine's ratings to be 40 countries higher. Can we expect maybe some concrete steps to match the rhetoric on everybody's side, Ukraine, U.S., and EU?
Thanks. Question for David. Recognizing the situation as it is with the EU and its feelings vis-a-vis Ukraine, I guess the real question, I think, sort of to repeat what Steve asked, is should the U.S. pick up the slack at this point, recognizing the situation to be what it is, and how can we? And just to clarify on my line about Ukraine isn't going anywhere, I meant to say Ukraine's not going away in the sense that the U.S. has interests there that are constant, regardless of what the leadership says. Just like this, I agree with you, Bill, that the Ukraine fatigue metaphor is a bad one. You get fatigued of people, and you stop talking to them. Countries, you know, are there, whether you like it or not. That doesn't change based on your mood.
Megan Iverson, I'm a naval researcher, and this question's for the panel. In the panel's view, does Ukraine's developing relations with Asia, particularly with the sale of military technology and hardware to China, have implications for its relations with both Russia and the U.S.?
Andre, do you want to start?
Oh, indeed. Thank you very much for your question. And it is, I think, taken for granted that the success of Ukraine is the main responsibility of the Ukrainian government and the Ukrainian authorities. And to behave in a civilized way, you don't need any incentives, you know. So it should go very naturally. Unfortunately, there are certain problems, avoidable problems. But I think that I hope very much that the direction will be, there will be a right direction. And the new administration proud itself on what it declares and delivers. So it set very specific tasks in terms of attracting foreign investment, that is deregulation, substantial deregulation, liquidation of debts on VAT to foreign companies and to any company, in fact, and a lot of other things. Easing of tax burden, tax vacations for those who would like to invest in certain areas, which is already happening. And Ukraine obviously has to do its part of homework. Now, David, I hate to disagree with you one more time, but this is a thing that actually is, keeps on repeating from now and then, that if you go, who is going where? Okay, Ukraine wants to go to the European Union. Does it mean that it's only Ukraine's responsibility? I mean, partnership is mutual responsibility, that there are steps forward. And it's not just sitting on the fence and evaluating. Okay, if Ukraine is a success story, we would write it to our account. If it's a failure, we're very tired. I don't think it's a very innovative policy. I would like also to say, to react to what our Polish colleague was saying, that Ukraine, I know there are two jokes, actually, I would like to tell, if possible. The first is when I was in Brussels, the joke was like mid-90s, that Ukraine pretends it wants to join the European Union, and we pretend that we believe them. Now, the situation, I think the situation has changed, because every time I try to understand whether European partners are ready for Ukrainian application, I think they take the threat very seriously. The second joke is about, famous Henry Kissinger's, whom do I call for, what's the number to call, and what's the person to call when you want to know the European attitude on something. Now we have, obviously, Catherine Ashton. So when an American secretary, whoever calls, he hears Mrs. Ashton's voice saying, please press 1 for German position, press 2 for UK position, and press 3 for French position. Yes. But I think on Ukraine, they can still speak with one voice. So you could call Mrs. Ashton in this particular case. And it is really very unfortunate.
Okay. David, Bill, do you want to take up Sam's question?
Should the U.S. pick up the slack? It can't, I don't think. We can't offer the same things that the EU can. On association agreement, on free trade. We need to be sure we have the kind of relationships with the Europeans where we can weigh in. And Steve's point about Turkey is absolutely right. I remember at a conference a little over a year ago, a former senior French official said, after President Obama had been to Turkey, would you please tell your president to shut up? The EU doesn't like when the U.S. pushes on membership issues or telling the EU what to do. But this gets at the point of making sure we have a good, coherent policy with Europe that isn't just about Afghanistan or Iraq, but it's also about completing the vision we have for Europe as a whole. So it seems to me we can do it in different ways. It doesn't have to be a public berating, but I think certainly having meetings devoted to this issue is what we need and haven't yet had.
Yes, I would like to answer Andrew, because he would like to disagree with me. The problem is I agree with you on the reading of the situation in the European Union. There are a lot of drawbacks, and the European Union is not able, willing to have a long-term vision of how to deal with Ukraine. But we have to face the reality, and I'm not a spokesman of the Minister Sikorski, but most probably he wanted to say, okay, we are not able to win a battle about the membership perspective for Ukraine, so let's do the job. Let's do a job step by step. Let's influence the instruments that are possible. It was Minister Sikorski who was very much engaged in working out the Eastern Partnership project. Okay, we may be critical about some elements that are not included into the project, but it gives us a possibility to conclude talks on association agreement, to have a visa-free regime, to have a deep and comprehensive free trade area, to have some additional financing of cooperation between European Union and Ukraine. Okay, maybe it is a problem of a glass of water, whether it is half full or half empty. I may agree with you that it is half empty, if you like.
No. It's just, let's, in the most dramatic hypothesis, imagine that European partnership never existed. What would have changed?
There was also the question about Asia.
Who would like to answer the question on Ukrainian arms sales to China and the impact on relations with both Russia and the United States?
I mean, from my perspective, Ukraine-China relationship is up to Ukraine. There are other countries that sell arms to China, including Russia. Where I do have concerns are with a different country Ukraine has been dealing with, and that's Burma. And that's an issue that we have discussed with the previous government, and I certainly hope we're discussing the current one, too.
Okay. Let's take 3 more questions.
My name is Hugh Grindstead. The Ukrainian overseas population, does it have any effect on policy in Ukraine? And is there a tug sometimes between those who have been overseas and studied and gone back and the people who really believe in unity with Russia?
Thank you. My name is Zach Whitland. I'm going to be starting a Fulbright Fellowship in Ukraine in 2 months. And I'm very curious about how the prospects for energy security or stability in Ukraine could affect relationships with the EU or their interest in Ukraine.
Andy Bihun from the Washington Group. I'd like to ask two questions, actually. One specifically of Andriy, when he mentioned earlier, on the expanding and certainly the prospective relationship, particularly economic, trade and investment, I hope, with China. Has there been progress in some underpinnings already and some expansion of institutional expertise, so to speak, both in China and in Ukraine, to proceed in that direction of expanding the trade and investment area? Something concrete that we can point to. Secondly, Anders had mentioned earlier, and a lot of us have heard it before, that the plan for reform, and particularly in the economic sphere, that would include energy reform, hopefully as a starter, has been well laid out. I'd like to know what your opinions would be, let's say, from those of the United States, currently or even in the past, based on thoughts there, as well as the European Union and Ukraine itself. What are the real prospects of getting some of those finally started and completed, hopefully starting with energy reform, which I think is going to be critical as a starter at this point?
Andrew, do you want to crank the first question?
What was the question?
First question was the impact of Ukrainian diaspora overseas, including Ukrainians who go overseas, study, then come back to Ukraine. What impact are they having on Ukraine
today?
What influence?
I mean, I'll be more than happy to answer to your question if I knew the response. I mean, hypothetically, of course, Ukrainians going overseas, benefiting from different cultures, different experiences, different know-how, will only improve Ukraine's international, let's put it this way, standing and competitiveness. So the more Ukrainians go overseas, and hopefully come back then, I think the more competitive Ukraine becomes, because they bring with them new experiences. They break away with their Soviet past, and they bring in new mentality, which is very welcome. Because I think a lot of things that go wrong in Ukraine go wrong not because there's some evil intention, but because just people were not living under different conditions. And this gulp of fresh air is very welcome, indeed, if I answered your question.
Okay. Next question on energy security.
And the European Union. Could you be more specific?
Thank you. How would prospects of Ukraine's future energy security affect the European Union's interest or feeling toward possible membership of Ukraine?
Well, the truth is that there's no talk of Ukraine's membership in EU, so they don't think how this or that thing will affect it. But Ukraine is interested in the stability of supplies from Russia to EU. That's its main concern. And it's obviously interested in having a transparent and understandable system of energy supply in Ukraine itself. So, but I would like to say that the last crisis demonstrated that our European friends, for good reasons, were mostly interested in having Russian gas delivered to them. That's the most important thing they cared about.
The only thing to add to that is the EU has been active in the energy field with regard to Ukraine. And, 18 months ago or so, there was a conference where the EU promised to do some things if Ukraine took some energy reform steps. And the things that were on offer included financing for upgrading of the transport system, the gas transport system, which would be a benefit for Ukraine. It would be a clear benefit for the EU as well. So the EU has shown interest and indeed has offered to put up real resources in that regard.
But Bill, if I may, it exactly confirms that the EU is interested in pursuing its interests, that is having secure supply of Russian gas to EU. The problem with us is, among other things, that we are expected to upgrade our capacity of pumping gas transportation system without commitments from the EU side that they will be buying this amount of gas, and without commitment from Russia that they will be pumping this amount of gas. So we may end up in investing $2 or $3 billion and face a situation where Russia will construct two bypasses and our gas transportation system will transport not 50% more gas but 50% less. And this is a real question which is not yet addressed.
If I could, isn't there even before that an initial issue, which is that, you know, I don't see how the European Union makes any investment in the Ukrainian gas sector until there's some disentanglement of the transit pipelines from the domestic gas distribution net. Because if I were sitting in Europe and saying, yes, I would like to make an investment in Ukraine to upgrade those pipelines bringing gas to Europe, you know, but I would not want to be in a position where I'm subsidizing Naftogaz, which has been on the verge of bankruptcy for the last 5 years.
Absolutely, yeah. But there's a whole set of things which will happen. And I think that the ideal plan is not to invest in a new capacity that would go through Ukrainian territory, Russia, Ukraine, EU, for a new transportation route. Mm-hmm. But obviously this question needs to be addressed, and I think that I haven't read it yet. The new law on deregulation of gas, something was adopted in Verkhovna Rada, mm-hmm. which EU wanted us to adopt, and I think if it's adopted without any minor amendments, that's a step in the very right direction.
Okay. Adam?
Well, Western parties, European Union, have offered Ukraine to improve the efficiency of the gas transit system and put some billions euro on the table. And there is no answer from Ukraine on this particular problem. And when it comes to the transit across Ukraine, it was an agreement between Gazprom and Naftogaz Ukraine signed by, it was an agreement about the deliveries of gas 10 years Prime Minister Tymoshenko, and it was also an agreement about the volume of transit of natural gas across territory of Ukraine, but which states that it will be 120 billion cubic meters a year. So it is decided as long as Ukraine doesn't
change.
It's
not yet decided, unfortunately, yeah. Because there are no penalties if our Russian friends decide not to transport
And
this is what happened.
Okay, so it is a problem of Prime Minister Tymoshenko, who accepted the deal without any penalties in case Russia does not go along with the decision.
Yeah, I could have agreed with you here.
Yeah. Again.
But again, she was... This was one of the most disastrous deals in Ukrainian history. But again, she was sandwiched between Russia and European Union, because European Union, I think for a right reason partly, wasn't interested in the details of Ukraine-Russia negotiations. They said, we need gas and we need it now. We're not interested. Point.
Okay. Does someone want to take a crack at the question on Ukraine-China trade and investment?
Well, I am not an expert how U.S. may react, so... Okay. Or Russia may react. Yeah. Russia doesn't like competition, obviously, but I think that with China, I mean, this is a safe bet. If you agree on something, that you can fully follow it up.
Steve, on the other of Andy's questions about reforms, and in particular energy reforms, prospects of getting started, Andre has already spoken to the commitment on the part of the new government for these things. But I think Anders, who has, but he made the point earlier that the IMF conditions are very strong in the area of economic reform, in particular on energy reform, in particular on gas pricing. So those, one would think, would be great incentives to take some of these steps.
And it'll be a very near indicator because, as I understand it, the prior condition, or one of the two prior conditions, is that Ukraine, by Thursday, raise its gas prices by 50% to domestic consumers. Okay, next set of questions.
Will the European Cup offer some antidote to the fatigue on both sides?
Mitchell Pullman, in your initial presentation, you mentioned that average Ukrainians are very frustrated with the conditions for obtaining visas at U.S. consulates and embassies. I just hope you recognize that that's not a Ukraine-specific problem, nor is it a new problem. This has been a problem that U.S. embassies and consulates have been wrestling with for decades worldwide. It's a question of resources. I can understand why an average citizen may not understand that, but I just want to be sure that I understand correctly that you are just characterizing the public viewpoint.
Okay, one more question.
Good idea. Thank you. Panagiota Manoli from the Woodrow Wilson Center. Does Ukraine still see any value in its participation in regional schemes like the GUAM, the Community for Democratic States, or Black Sea Economic Cooperation, and the initiatives like connecting the Baltics with the Black Sea in its, you know, in its plans for integrating further in the European scheme, or as tools in its relations with the U.S., Russia, EU, etc.? Thank you.
Okay, shall we start with the question on the European Cup?
European Cup is a great thing, and I think one has to thank the European Football Association for their patience. But I think Ukraine will deliver in the end, and it will be a spectacular event. And Ukraine has a new coach, football team, and part of its contract is that Ukraine has to win the championship. So another realistic goal.
There is no fatigue when we are talking about Euro Cup. It is a common disappointment that neither Poland nor Ukraine qualified for the last World Cup in South Africa. But we have also quite good plans for the 2012, so I don't know who will be better.
The Polish-Ukrainian battle in the final.
Let's hope.
Yes. Okay.
In Kiev's national stadium.
Okay.
And visa.
I mean, I take this issue very close to my heart, and I don't remember whether I bombarded one of the ambassadors with requests, but certainly their consul generals. Now, first, we know that the problem exists, but we know that the international obligations exist as well. So I think, again, here are the things that don't match. We remember the Soviet times where citizens were deprived of the freedom of travel to the West by the Soviet authorities. I don't think it makes much relief to Ukrainian citizens now to be deprived of the right to travel because of the decision of the Western embassies. It is true that a lot of improvement have been made, but you have to. I worked in an embassy in Brussels, and people were calling now and then and saying, "Can I have the documents sent by post? I have to travel an hour and a half to your embassy." Now, people have to travel one day to the embassy of a Western country. I don't know what's the situation in the U.S. embassies, but I know in European countries. Spend 3 or 4 days in the queues, come up there at about 6 o'clock in the morning for a checkup, and then in the heat or in the Russian winter, whatever. And in the end, 10% is the official figure of rejections. And I can tell you one story. I have many stories, but I can tell you one story. The German gentleman wanted to date and possibly marry a Ukrainian woman, and they were in their 50s. Obviously, she was deprived of visa. I lobbied her many times, and once she was stamped that she can't go. I asked the German ambassador, said she's in tears, said no more tears in Ukrainian-German relations. They gave her visa. In a year, he went to Paris, and he wasn't that sensitive, so she has her entry rejected, Germany. Now,
Their relationship reached a critical point. He had to divorce. They wanted to have more time to explore their relationship, and they were in their 50s. But they couldn't meet each other. So he had to divorce his wife, go all through the legal process, have a quarrel with his children over this. She went there, she was happy for 2 months, and now she's crying. Now, I mean, this is a very small example, but it shows to what sufferings and strains it subjects the citizens, where basically the problem is not there. She was traveling there for quite a time while she was refused a visa in the first place. He had made a decision that affected his life, and he was in his early 60s, I think. And so what? It's a question which unfortunately has very high social and emotional cost and needs to be addressed in the proper way.
Yeah, let me add, because when I was in Ukraine, I spent more time on visa and consular questions than I would have liked to. First of all, I mean, I think the situation under that you described characterized some embassies, including the American embassy when I got there. I mean, we used to have, you come, you stand in line, and up to 200 people we would take a day, and if you didn't get in that queue, then you came back the next day. Actually, our consular section proposed instituting an appointment system, which I'll tell you candidly, I said, I don't think it's going to work. But let's try it. And to my great surprise, it actually did work. And I think it continues to this day, where
it's even online now. It's
online now. So you need to apply online 3 weeks in advance, but you're told this day, you know, I think you're given a half hour slot. So you have to come to Kyiv, but you know you're at the embassy at 2:30 and that you'll be seen by a consular officer in about 30 minutes. So at least I think we've improved the process there.
And that's very important.
Yeah. Now, the other part of the problem, though, and is one that's just not in Ukraine, it's of course, the refusal rate, which tends to be, I think, higher than, you know, would like to see, I think higher than Ukrainians would like to see. But it gets tied to questions like the number of overstays and such, which still continues to be a problem. And a basic fact that American visa law, and it's not just in Ukraine, it's worldwide, it's what I would call unconstitutional. And I would say in defense of consular officers, what they are told is that they have to assume that an applicant is either an intending immigrant or coming for illegal purposes or to overstay. That's the assumption. And then the applicant has to prove he or she will not do all of that. So it's kind of that flip. And it puts a different burden on the consular officer, which I think most consular officers, and I did my time as a consular officer 3 years ago in Poland, it's a burden that I think most consular officers would like to be relieved of, but, you know, there's the law. Question on regional cooperation.
Well, I think the new administration is reassessing all projects from the pragmatic point of view. President Yanukovych was asked a question on Guam in Strasbourg end of late April, and he said, I don't know yet the answer, let's see. I'm open to suggestions. If it's emphasis on economic issues, then I think we'll go forward. To the credit of the U.S. Officials, they have been warning against, shall we say, over ambitious plans for Guam. So that first, the countries should think what is the real project there, and then U.S. will support it, but they shouldn't try to have very, very ambitious plans when they don't have the capacities to fulfill them. And I very vividly remember Madeleine Albright was actually basically saying this to the foreign ministers. Unfortunately, people were not having the same possibility as I had to listen to it, so there was a kind of perception that Guam is a very much U.S.-driven plan. And even some of our, frankly, European friends said that, why on earth are you pursuing this? Well, it's American plan. Well, what's in up for you? But the problem there is that if there is serious substance, obviously it will be pursued. I don't see, frankly, any prospect in Baltic and Black Sea. I mean, again, it's a ringing declaration. But when all countries north of Ukraine, mm-hmm. are already in the EU, I don't think they're not much interested in having something separate. So. So I don't see a raison d'etre for any scheme like this. What was the other one? Black Sea, yes, Black Sea economic cooperation is interesting, and it's regional, and it will be, I think. There are projects, not very ambitious, but there are projects which are there. Turkey is very ambitious about its leadership. Russia is taking an active part, so I think it has a future, although not as ambitious as some would have liked it to have. Yeah.
Okay. I think we have time for one last question.
Thank you. I'm a student from Moldova. My name is Violeta Teutu. You have mentioned Catherine Ashton. So my question is, would the administration in Kyiv salute, let's say, initiative to call back the EU special envoys to Moldova and Caucasus?
Oh, absolutely. Ukraine is supporting, and Ukraine's support is critical. Without it, EU mission would have been impossible. And as you know, as you may know, we have included...
She suggested to call back the envoys, the EU envoys to Moldova and Georgia.
I didn't know that. No,
Kalman Meshed, to basically end his mandate and not renew it, put somebody else there.
I'm sorry, I'm not aware of this, so I wouldn't like to comment. Basically, it's a question to EU, what it believes it's most expedient. EU believed that it was very expedient to have a mission there, and we agreed. If EU believes that it's not expedient...
The solution of the Trans-Eastern conflict...
We don't know in the first place what is going on between EU and Russia on Transnistria. Now, you may have known this Merkel-Medvedev joint initiative for whatever EU-Russia Council. It took everyone by surprise, to say the least, in the European Union, because 5 days before they had a European Council and nobody mentioned it. And then in 5 days there was this initiative. But everyone I spoke to in Brussels said that it's kind of a test. If Russia... will be willing to cooperate with the EU, then it should be given something in return. And that's litmus test is Transnistria. EU believes that this is the issue that can be solved with the goodwill of Russia. So maybe something is going on there, I don't know.
Can I just, as the former U.S. representative for the 5+2 process, paying for my sins, I think it's important for the EU to keep an envoy in both the South Caucasus and Moldova. I think it doesn't send a great signal to terminate their mandates. But as I mentioned, the solution to this problem is in Russia. If the Russians decide to pull out their forces and decide it's time to resolve what is the easiest frozen conflict to solve, then it can get solved. But so far, to this date, they haven't done so.
Wait, but, and again, a very important thing is that when there was a lot of talk about possible declaration of Medvedev and Yanukovych in Transnistria, and you got very nervous if it were excluded from the process. So they insisted on being included in the process, and I do hope that being involved in the process means doing something.
Strategic patience. That's what we need. We need strategic patience both with Ukraine and with the EU. I mean, the EU will change. Ukraine will still be there.
Right. Okay, on those wise words, let me ask you all please to join me in thanking our panel.